You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I'm currently on a book tour around the United States and hope to see you. Find the schedule of my events at warisalie.org. It's my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Micah Capps Schubert. She is the co-founder and current manager of The Clearing Barrel GI Coffee House in Kaiserslautern, next to the Rammstein Air Base in Germany. This is the only GI Coffee House outside the United States. A longtime peace and justice activist in Germany, Micah is a counselor with the Military Counseling Network, the German branch of the GI Rights Hotline, which provides free, confidential, and accurate information on U.S. military regulations and practices to members of the U.S. military, veterans, and their families. She has also helped build critical support for U.S. war resistors in Germany since 2003. Micah Capps Schubert, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David.
It's wonderful to learn. I didn't know that there is a GI Coffee House in Germany. I know this is a tradition from the Vietnam War era, and I've heard of and been to recently opened coffee houses in Texas and I think in Washington State. Is there really nothing like this in Korea or Japan or Italy? I mean, you're the only one outside the United States?
Yes, as far as I know, yeah, we're the only ones outside the U.S. Doing the work with the GI Rights Hotline. Yeah, there should be more, but there unfortunately there isn't. Yeah, I mean, it was the cafe, the GI Coffee House, has been here since 2012. But in general, the work of the Military Council Network has quite a long tradition. It kind of started off in the mid-80s, I think, founded by the German Mennonite Peace Committee to, yeah, basically work with U.S. conscience objectors. So I'm kind of like in a long tradition. Also, there were, as far as I know, like especially like during the Vietnam times, there were places like this here in Germany during the Vietnam War times. Of course, in that time, there were like so much more American troops stationed over here in Germany and Europe, for that matter. But yes, so far I'm the only one doing it outside the U.S., so to say.
How many U.S. troops are still in Germany now, and is it rising or shrinking? I know some have moved to Italy. I used to live in Vicenza, Italy, and they've built a massive new U.S. military base there and moved some troops down there. Are U.S. troops in Germany shrinking in number or growing?
Yeah, it's kind of like constantly changing. I mean, they of course there was quite a drop in around like between 2011 and 2012, like when officially the Iraq War ended. But right now, they're actually they're sending troops back to Germany. They kind of reopen bases they closed in 2012. Right now, they're talking about like needing like an additional 5,000 troops along the edge of Europe. You know, like going east, so to say. And what they're doing right now, they kind of reactivate bases around the area here in Kaiserslautern and Rammstein. So yeah, it's an on and off depending on what's going on in the politics, so to say. There were times there were like many, many more soldiers stationed in Germany or Europe, for that matter. You mentioned Vicenza and in Italy, and German bases they like belong together. So they're in Italy, but they basically belong together. And what happened in the recent years is that they, of course, did close bases down, but on the other end, they expanded other bases, and they just kind of, it seems like, yeah, like they're concentrating on lesser bases but bigger ones, let's say.
And there are still many thousands of U.S. troops there.
It's really hard to tell because, of course, like, it's really hard to, like, find official numbers. And as I just said, it's kind of like changing on and off. I think like the official number right now is like 50,000 troops in Germany. But yeah, it's kind of hard to tell because of, yeah, constantly changing troop level. But what we see here right now is that troops are coming back.
And so what does your work, what does your work consist of? Are troops contacting you who are interested in getting out, in becoming conscientious objectors, in deserting, going AWOL, resisting in various ways?
Yeah, and that's also kind of changing over the years. Of course, like especially like during the beginning of the Iraq War, we worked with a lot of conscientious objectors, but also with quite some troops coming back from their first or second deployment and going AWOL because they didn't know how to get out. But right now, that's not so much the topic. In the recent years, of course, we had a lot to do, yeah, with military personnel being highly, suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, not getting help from inside the military, but also a lot of people just being kicked out for disciplinary problems, and then it kind of changed to like trying to help people to, yeah, not just being kicked out and losing all their benefits, but helping them to find help first off with their PTSD problems, but also trying to help them to get their benefits. It's a constant change.
But in recent years, there have been cases that have made the news over here of U.S. soldiers in Germany refusing to fight. Some of the names like Augustin Aguayo and Andre Shepard, some of our listeners may have heard of. And you worked with IVAW and some of these and Veterans for Peace and some of these soldiers and held a public winter soldier hearing and other public events of that sort, didn't you?
Yes. Especially like between, I think, like 2005 and 2009, there were quite some soldiers going there going for conscience objection. And also they went public a lot. But if you look back, I mean, that's quite, it's just like 6, 7, 8 years ago. But we still work with Andrew Shepard. His case is still not resolved, so to say. He's like kind of still hanging in the air about what's going on with his asylum case. There's like no decision made yet, and so that's still ongoing.
But he's living in Germany waiting to legally live in Germany.
Yes, he's living in Germany, and I mean he's quite on the safe side, but not totally endangered right now. But he definitely wants to go through with his case, and it seems like it's like really, I don't know if you say that in English, it's like a time play from official side because no one wants to make a decision on that.
Well, at least it's not a bad decision. So what does life look like at the coffee house? You have concerts and public events, and you meet troops and provide counseling.
Yes. Well, a lot of the counseling questions, because like obviously not every American soldier is stationed right here in Kaiserslautern, so a lot of the counseling questions go via email. Well, most of it goes via email because not everyone is here in K-Town, so to say. But the coffee house, yes, it kind of like it changed a little bit over the last 4 years. Like right from the beginning, it was always important to me, you know, like to also have like a cultural events here, and like movie nights, but also like information evenings, speaking events, all kinds of things. Interesting enough, it kind of became like a meeting point for all kinds of people, not only American military people, but also like younger people who are engaged in peace work, and also a lot of people who are involved in anti-fascist work over here, because that's obviously a big topic. And so there's like a really good mixture of all kinds of people that use the cafe as a meeting point or for their events.
Yeah,
we also have like a pretty good selection of like info materials, like books and all kinds of flyers and pamphlets. And I think like if people will come in, they can already see where we're coming from. This is like clearly like an anti-war cafe. Right now we do have this exhibition up, like the exhibition from IVAW, like posters talking about what IVAW did from 2004 till 2014. So people can clearly tell what this is all about.
Very good. We're speaking with Micah Capps-Schubert, who is the co-founder and the current manager of the Clearing Barrel GI Coffee House in Kaiserslautern next to Rammstein Air Base. What has changed, if anything, in your work since Rammstein's role in drone murders around the world has become a big news topic, and there have been new activist campaigns started up against Rammstein to shut down that operation or to shut down the base entirely. I know that we at RootsAction.org are launching a petition together with a lot of other organizations asking the U.S. and German governments to shut down Rammstein entirely. How have those issues played into your work?
Well, Rammstein was already here when we came here with the cafe.
Sure.
And to me, it was always pretty clear what's happening over there. Luckily, like a lot about the drone operations was quite in the press the last, I would say, 2 or 3 years. So it became more and more a topic also in the German public. But it still kind of seems that because a lot of people in Germany are not aware about Rammstein Air Base and not even aware of still having like so many American troops over here. It's a thing like more in the south of Germany. So I just recently met some people in Hamburg, and they are just like totally unaware that there's still troops here. So yeah, it is a big topic
People are unaware that there are still U.S. troops in Germany at all, or just in Rammstein?
No, in Germany at all. I mean, it's basically most of the military, the U.S. installations are like more in the south of Germany. So you clearly have people not knowing that there are still troops in Germany, just because they have nothing to do with it or never had Americans in their area. That's weird. That's how it really is.
It's incredible to me. Oh. I mean, I saw a new film this week called The Bomb Hunters about the 100,000 bombs from the U.S. and the British still hidden in the ground in Germany and still killing people. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a World War II still going on in all of these ways, and the troops have never left, and people don't know it. On the other hand, I spoke to a group of Democratic Party activists this past week who had managed not to know that President Obama is killing people around the world with drones. So I think it's entirely possible for people to avoid knowing things. Education has to be a big part of your work.
Well, also, we had areas in Germany where, you know, like after the Second World War, you know, like they had like other Allied troops stationed. Like if you go more to the northwest, you have like British troops stationed there. People are just not aware that it's still ongoing, so to say.
You mentioned anti-fascism activism, and this has come up in relation to protesting Rammstein, that the peace groups don't want to work with the fascists who also oppose the U.S. bases, but are racists and sexists and so forth. Is that a major problem for the peace movement in Germany?
I would say yes. I understand if it's like really hard to, at least from an American perspective, to understand like the internal struggles going on here in the peace movement. That's been going on for quite some years. It's like an internal discussion. It's not solved yet. Some parts of the peace movement are just like open for to right-wing groups, and other groups are not.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a little bit of discussions and struggles going on, and it makes things complicated, of course.
Also,
Germany is probably a bit weird to explain.
It is. There's also the opposite approach to, the extreme approach to Israel and Palestine issues that you find in Germany. Other thing I think may have impacted your work, about 5 years ago, you told me Germany became a so-called all-volunteer army, military, just like the United States. And so people go into the military because they want to or because they need the money and so forth. So is counter-recruitment among young Germans part of what you engage in now?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, like to me, it's sometimes like a little bit of, like a deja vu, like the discussions I've been having inside the peace movement like many years ago, where when I was telling people that I work with American soldiers, that people were going like, well, why? Why are they complaining? You know, like they choose to be part of the military and now they come back and complain about it. And interesting enough, I have the same discussions again about the German army.
Yeah.
It's been a big change since they changed into a all-volunteer military. The problems are basically the same that we know of the U.S. military. Not in the big scale as the U.S. military, of course, because it's much smaller. We're like really going down the same path, so to say. There's a lot of effort and a lot of money put into recruiting people in schools and, doing these nice festivals, you know, like and inviting young kids to, look at like the tanks and the weapons and things. So we're basically doing the same as in the U.S. And also I would say, in the U.S. we were always talking about a poverty trap. I think it's not as tough as in the U.S. because like there's still a little bit left of our social system. But it's clearly that a lot of very young people choose to join the military because of money reasons, you know, like they, of course, promise people, you know, like, come to us, you can have a career, you can, we pay your college and all that. So.
And are you counseling, are you helping young Germans find other alternatives than going in, and are you helping any get back out?
Sometimes I do have to do with German soldiers. The good thing is it's just kind of like slowly starting to be on topic. The good thing is that for many, many years, the church has did like really good work in helping these people to do like a civil service, like before we had a volunteer military, you were able to choose to do civil service. So these places or these organizations still do that kind of work. And as far as I know, like just recently, like the numbers of conscience objectors inside the German military are like rising on a really high level. And also because like the conscience objection cases are kind of like the decisions on that are made inside the military. Like the numbers of people getting denied are like really high as well, with the same argument, you know, like we put so much money in your education and they don't want to let people go. So it's slowly starting to, to be more and more in the public also. And, I do sometimes get, like, calls from soldiers just because they obviously found me on the Internet or a couple other sources that are out there. So it seems to me that this is probably something, if we like it or not, here in Germany, we have to create more awareness that there is large numbers of people who probably want to get out of the German military in the next years to come. And the same goes with, PTSD and soldiers or veterans having problems to get help inside the, like from the military. So we're having the same, the same problems getting bigger.
Yeah, you mentioned that you've worked with the Center on Conscience and War, which I know is a wonderful organization in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere, and that you try to work with other groups in the United States across borders on this work. I know that I work with World Beyond War, and we're trying to work with groups in Germany and with the International Peace Bureau and other activists there. How have you been able to benefit from working, you know, across borders with U.S. groups that are dealing with the same stuff?
The Center on Conscience and War, they are like our fiscal sponsor over here. We're like officially part of the GI Rights Hotline. I work like very close with people from the CCW regarding cases where I don't really know what to do. You know, like a lot of cases really require to have like a deep insight into military law, and I just don't have that. So if I get like if I have a case here where I just don't know what to do about it, I'm working with the CCW, and I've been doing this for many years, and they're like a really good partner in that. It's always kind of hard to network over the pond, it seems. I've been working with IVAW, actually since they've been around, because I always had the feeling, like, from over here, that IVAW does a brilliant work and is very close to the soldiers I work with. So, I've been working with them for a long time. I'm part of the Civilian Soldier Alliance, and also I'm working with people from the Veterans for Peace. I'm also a member. So there are these connections.
Sometimes
a little bit hard.
I think those are some of the best groups you could name. I am an associate member of Veterans for Peace and think everybody should be. I think a lot of people listening, a lot of people in the United States imagine that conscientious objectors and deserters and troops who go AWOL are extreme exceptions and rarities. And yet I've seen numbers above 50,000, in recent years, going AWOL from the U.S. military. How big do you think it is, and how common?
Yeah, it's People always ask that question. It's hard to tell. I could imagine that there are like way more U.S. Soldiers or veterans just somewhere here in Europe we don't even know of, because they didn't have any problems. They might be married to someone in Germany or Europe, for that matter, and not having the urge to kind of like, clear up the situation. So you never know. I mean, it's really hard to tell how much people are like really out there. You mentioned already a couple of kind of famous public cases. It's really hard to tell how many people are really out there, you know, like just living their life and not popping up somewhere.
We have just a couple minutes left. I read a good article that mentioned your work and was focused on a handful of different soldiers who left and I think were in Canada, at least some of them, and one had been assigned to welcome and comfort injured U.S. troops when they returned to a big hospital in Germany from wars abroad, the Landstuhl Regional Medical Center, and he hadn't been trained like a doctor to deal with seeing such horrors, and he was traumatized by it. Is that something you run into in Germany? Is troops, without even going off to war, are traumatized by all of the other troops coming back from the wars?
Not directly. Like on a personal level, but I can really see that this is happening a lot. I mean, especially here with the hospital and Landstuhl, you know, like that, you know, like everyone who was like wounded or harmed in any shape or form, so to say, was going via Landstuhl Hospital. And they're also expanding that, by the way. Not personally, but yes, I can see that. And also, I've been in contact with some of the people in Canada. And of course, like Andrew Shepard's case would be so important as a good example, especially for the people in Canada still kind of like waiting what's going to happen with them and are, you know, like sitting in church asylum for 7 or 8 years or even longer. So, yeah, Andrew Shepard's case is still kind of very important on like a really international level, so to say.
Well, we need those examples, but I think the example of having set up this coffee house in Germany should be an example to, 174 other countries around the world with U.S. troops in them. We've been speaking with Micah Capps-Schubert. She's the co-founder and manager of the Clearing Barrel GI Coffee House in Kaiserslautern. We will have links up on the website at talknationradio.org. Micah, thank you very, very much for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. I'm traveling around the United States right now doing events with my new book, War is a Lie, second edition. I hope to see you. Find the schedule of events at warisalie.org. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, in August of last year, El Salvador experienced one murder per hour. With Honduras and Guatemala, it's among the most violent places in the world, which, along with economic insecurity and government failures, spurs thousands of people to try and leave. Why, then, is the U.S. stepping up deportation of Central American families, sending them back to circumstances of hardship and danger? We'll speak with Suyapa Portillo, who teaches Chicano Latino Transnational Studies at Pitzer College in California. Also on the show, justice lost a champion with the May 11th death of Michael Ratner, human rights lawyer and president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. We spoke with Michael Ratner many times over the years. We'll bring you one of those conversations today. It's about the appointment of Alberto Gonzalez as U.S. Attorney General. And I assure you, it's as relevant now as it was then. The words of Michael Ratner later on today's Counterspin. But first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at the week's press. When did optimism become uncool? Wondered a May 12th New York Times Sunday Review piece by Greg Easterbrook. The problem? A Gallup poll showed just 26% of Americans say they're satisfied with the way things are going. Quote, yet a glance out the window shows blue sky, close quote. The country, Easterbrook tells us, quote, is on the whole in the best shape it's ever been in. So what explains all the bad vibes, close quote. Well, this is a category of story that might be termed journalistic gaslighting. Everything is actually good, the story says. So if you don't feel that way, maybe you're the problem. It's not even that hard to spot the manipulations it takes to get there. There are virtually contentless statements like, the American economy is number one by a huge margin. And the piece touts misleading data, like unemployment numbers, lower than in what some extol as the good old days, Easterbrook says. But they ignore labor force participation, which reckons how many people aren't counted as unemployed because they've stopped looking for jobs. That's lower than in those good old days. The piece scolds progressives who were told, quote, drank too deeply of instant doomsday claims, close quote. If their predictions had come true, quote, crop failures would be causing mass starvation, close quote. That's meant to be an example of laughable leftist hysteria, but it falls flat, given the UN World Food Program's announcement that malnutrition kills more than 3 million children a year. Is that not mass enough? By the end, we learn that there are injustices and hardships, but still, somehow the bigger problem is people who bellyache about them. Or, in Easterbrook's words, quote, climate change, inequality, and racial tension are viewed not as the next round of problems to be solved, but as proof that the United States is horrible. Optimists understand that where the nation has faults, it's time to roll up our sleeves and get to work, close quote. So we're destroying the planet and systemic racist and class-based oppression continues apace, but why won't people just let a smile be their umbrella? Of course, the truth is plenty of people have already rolled up their sleeves and are working at the very problems that Easterbrook suggests are just bumps in the road. Perhaps the Times could acknowledge and support those people instead of accusing them of bad vibes. In March of 1990, Fair noted that in all of the coverage of Nelson Mandela's release from 27 years of prison, no one mentioned the role of the CIA in his capture. In August of 1962, according to 1986 reports in the South African press, Mandela was traveling, disguised as a chauffeur, on his way to a secret meeting with the U.S. Vice Consul in Durban, Donald Ricard, a diplomat reputed to be a CIA officer. Ricard tipped off the South African authorities to the meeting, allowing Mandela to be apprehended. When Mandela died in 2013, we asked, can the story be told now? The answer was still no. When it was mentioned in big media, it was by the sort of folks you don't often see in big media. Amy Goodman mentioned it on Melissa Harris-Perry's show, and Cornel West noted it to Jake Tapper at CNN. Well, now we have news from the Sunday Times of London that before his death, Donald Ricard himself admitted it, and proudly. It was righteous, he said, because Mandela was believed to be a communist. Ricard told a British filmmaker, quote, "Mandela had to be stopped, and I put a stop to it," close quote. So what about now? Can U.S. media now acknowledge the U.S. role in imprisoning for decades a man they would subsequently herald as a world leader of human rights? Maybe think about that in terms of present-day U.S. involvement with rights movements around the... Oh, forget it. The answer is no. The New York Daily News referred to Ricard's bombshell admission, but for a bombshell, it was pretty darn quiet. We did get a Washington Post article, not in the paper, just on the blog, that said that Ricard's statement that he facilitated Mandela's arrest had reignited speculation that he had facilitated Mandela's arrest. Well, in Mandela's New York Times obituary, Bill Keller explained that he wasn't convinced of allegations of CIA involvement. Evidently, they weren't as compelling as the evidence of Iraq's WMDs, which did convince Keller. But the paper ran a letter to the editor from an historian named Stephen Ellis. Ellis noted that Keller had written about Mandela's membership in the South African Communist Party, which Ellis's research had found, but that neither the Times nor the U.S. government had acknowledged the CIA role in his capture, which his research had also noted. "It was a long time ago," Ellis wrote, "but the truth still counts." You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. If you come from some place because someone wanted to kill you, if you go back, they're going to kill you. Disturbing words from a young woman explaining to Al Jazeera why she made the perilous trip from El Salvador to the U.S. After being kidnapped and assaulted at age 16 by armed men, she became one of tens of thousands of children coming into the U.S. without a guardian from the three Central American countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, known as the Northern Triangle. Most are fleeing a level of violence that's hard to fathom, but the Obama administration is stepping up raids and deportations, which officials tell the New York Times are aimed mainly at Central American mothers and children. What's going on here, and what could journalists be asking about it besides what effect it might have on the election? Suyapa Portillo is assistant professor of Chicano Latino Transnational Studies at Pitzer College. She joins us now by phone from California. Welcome to Counterspin, Suyapa Portillo.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk about why people come from the Central American countries that are being targeted right now for deportation. It isn't because the journey is easy or because life is easy once you get here. And indeed, they aren't mainly coming here, despite the impression one might get. They're mainly trying to go to Belize or Costa Rica or Panama. But why do so many feel that they have to leave?
Looking at the individual countries, they have such a different history, right? Guatemala and El Salvador saw a protracted conflict in Guatemala since 1962, 1954, with over 200,000 murders and many, many more disappeared by the state and by U.S. collusion with the state. El Salvador saw over 70,000 murders by the military, again, with U.S. involvement in the 1980s. And the peace accords were signed in 1996 for Guatemala, 1992 for El Salvador. So that was really recent. And then you see these countries go from that, thrusted into neoliberal politics, export processing zones, and peace meant a transition into this ultra-capitalist system. What happens is those people couldn't find jobs, right? Mm-hmm. Going from the war, either they had to migrate because of death, and so many of them lost family members and came in the 1980s. And so the kids now want to reunite with those people that came in the 1980s, their parents, right? So that's one issue. The other issue is, what are these graduates going to do, these people that were children in the 1980s that are now adults? Where are they going to work? At a maquiladora, right, a sort of a sweatshop, which does not respect labor rights. That is what I think is at the crux of this. And everybody else is talking about violence and all this stuff, but, you know, that is violence, right? You go from an extreme authoritarian system into this free capital system. These countries haven't had a chance to transition into any kind of peace, right? Any kind of normal functioning. So when we think about why people are coming, well, people have been coming since the 1980s. It's just that they were coming and living in the shadows in the 1980s to escape the violence. Over 97% of asylum claims in the 1980s were denied political asylum. And, you know, that continues today with Central Americans. It seems like if the U.S. were to acknowledge Central Americans, it's almost like it would acknowledge its complicity. The State Department would acknowledge its complicity with the level of violence that has been happening, not just right now, but over 100 years in the region.
I want to pull out a point that you made in the midst of that, which is that while the U.S. was in the midst of the dirty wars in Central America under the Reagan administration, you said that over 97% of Central Americans were denied political asylum at that time.
Exactly.
And that there's a sense that to acknowledge that they were fleeing and were deserving of asylum would have meant talking about the U.S.'s role in creating the situation that they were fleeing. And in some sense, that is still the case today. Well, let's come up to today, because when I read what coverage there is, I see Department of Homeland Security representatives telling the New York Times, well, we're just enforcing the law consistent with our priorities, you know, and another official told The Guardian, we have to deport these people essentially because we can only grant asylum when a person's fear is based on specific grounds, race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group or of a political opinion.
I would say the last two, membership in a political group and a protected category of belonging to a social group, are critical here for Central American mothers and children. To apply for political asylum, you have to prove a couple of things. You have to prove credible threats, meaning if you received threats via email, cell phone. Nowadays, we have so many more ways to receive threats. Back in the day, it was a white hand painted outside your door or just someone telling you, hey, they're going to come after you, and then people had to flee. It was really hard for people that had to flee, particularly Mayan Guatemalans, who didn't even speak Spanish sometimes. And there was no coverage in the newspaper because the newspapers are controlled by the elite and the right wing, right? It's really hard to provide that sort of material evidence in wars that have been covert, in documents that are sitting at our State Department archives that are blacked out, massacres that happened. We know that over 50 U.S. military advisors were in Guatemala in the 1980s, right? They were writing reports. Those reports are sitting in those archives, but we don't have access to them. So how do we prove, yeah, there was a massacre?
Exactly. Even folks like Nancy Pelosi, you know, are coming forward and saying, this is not the approach. You know, I mean, even if we're not going to acknowledge the U.S.'s role in creating the instability and the violence in these countries, sending these people back to it is just no kind of solution. You're talking about gender, which I think is also fascinating. It's not listed as a protected category, and yet, you know, U.S. asylum officers spoke with like 16,000 women from the Northern Triangle in Mexico and found 82% had credible fears of persecution and torture, and yet this is not enough to make them refugees. But let's come to the present moment and to what folks are trying to do. I know there's been a lot of anger and resistance to this surge of raids and deportations, but what are folks calling for? What do we see as the other response? What else could we do?
The most important thing to do is to demand from your local legislators, demand that they stop the deportations, to begin to link the issues of Central American women and children, gang members, LGBT trans women, because for so long we've been talking about immigration in the context of families, right? The president said, you know, we don't want to deport families, we want to deport felons. But we really need to band together here as all deportable people, right, to really begin to demand from our elected officials some clear and strong resistance to what the Obama administration is doing. It's really important that they're not lying. They're coming from Guatemalan Hondurans are neoliberal right-wing governments that are not doing anything for people, that are not creating jobs, that are not bringing peace, that are not enforcing security or even prosecuting any of the murders, right? Talking about women in Honduras, in 2012, there were over 600 murders of women. Not one of those has been prosecuted. 200 murders of LGBT folks since 2009. Not one has been prosecuted or brought to investigation. It is a completely flawed judicial system. The country's in chaos. In Guatemala, we saw the protest just a few months ago that corruption runs all the way up to the presidency. In Honduras, we see protests. All of these messages that Washington's not picking up on, that they're being tone deaf about, and they're not really listening, that the people are not supporting those governments and that those governments are excruciatingly painful for people and that that's why they're leaving. The other thing is, because these countries were in war for so long, the ability to rebuild society after World War II, maybe for many Americans, they may think, well, it wasn't World War II, you know. But for us Central Americans, it was the most devastating situation to have ever lived. The majority of my mom's lifetime as an adult, she lived under a military dictatorship. I was born during a military dictatorship. We experienced not being able to freely travel from one city to another, military presence in our cities, right? So for us to rebuild our countries, it's going to take some time, and it's not going to happen through military intervention. It's going to happen through assistance and programs and listening to what people need. Europe didn't rebuild itself. Everybody helped to rebuild Europe after World War II. What is the U.S. doing to help rebuild Central America after their involvement in the 1980s? Absolutely nothing.
Well, what would be one question that you would like reporters to be asking right now about this that they're not?
What are the countries doing to receive immigrants? The Latino press, the Spanish press covers this a little bit. 350 million went down to the Northern Triangle from the U.S. to help receive people, to provide services and school programs for deported kids. But I think they're pocketing that money because I haven't seen one program. I read the Central American newspapers every morning. I haven't seen one program to surface, right? Usually the government promotes their programs. You know, there's supposed to be a shelter, but the shelters are limited. They only give people one day to sleep and a sandwich. That's what I've heard. So I think an interesting story would be like, well, we're sending people back, but what is the government doing for them over there? Like, how are they assisting them to reintegrate into society, right? We talk a lot about integration here, but we don't talk about integration there. I think that would be cool to cover in English because I see a little bit in Spanish. My assumption is these governments are just pocketing that money and they're developing, like, quote-unquote security, right? Like military police. I'm shocked that we're sort of just looking at our neighbor and we're not thinking, well, what happens to these hundreds of thousands of people that are being deported and how are they reintegrating and not just being killed, but, you know, what is the government doing for them?
We've been speaking with Suyapa Portillo of Pitzer College. I'd like to thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin. Suyapa Portillo.
Thank you so much.
Michael Ratner, who passed away last week at the age of 72, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights, investigated, defended, and spoke up for victims of human rights abuses around the world. He didn't inspire hundreds of lawyers because he won cases, but because he saw law as an instrument of justice. Ratner brought the first challenge under the War Powers Resolution Act to the use of U.S. troops in El Salvador. He prosecuted U.S. officials on behalf of Nicaraguans murdered by the Contras, and he made CCR the first human rights organization to stand up for the rights of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. His work will live on. Here's Michael Ratner interviewed by Counterspin Steve Rendell in November 2004 on the occasion of Alberto Gonzalez's nomination to be U.S. Attorney General.
Since George W. Bush's announcement on November 10th that he was nominating his presidential counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, to replace outgoing U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft, the nomination has faced surprisingly little scrutiny from Democrats or the media. This should be surprising as Gonzalez is responsible for advising Bush that Geneva Convention restraints on treatment of enemy prisoners are obsolete, for contributing to a memo advising the president that torturing alleged al-Qaeda terrorists in captivity abroad may be justified, and for defending the current U.S. practice of detaining alleged enemy combatants without access to lawyers or courts. Joining us now is one of the few strong critics of the Gonzalez nomination. Michael Ratner is the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is suing to force the Bush administration to grant hearings to detainees held at Guantanamo Bay. Welcome back to Counterspin, Michael Ratner.
Thank you for having me.
Michael, you're quoted in the November 22nd edition of Time magazine saying, quote, "I think in some ways Gonzalez is more dangerous than Ashcroft. The person who really took the U.S. outside the law was Gonzalez," close quote. Considering Ashcroft's reputation, those are strong charges. Flesh them out for us a little bit, if you will.
Well, it's hard to believe a little bit on the surface because at first, you know, Ashcroft was really a lightning rod for violations of constitutional rights and similar kinds of activities. But when you look at what really happened, Ashcroft was an outsider here on what I consider the key issues. And the three key issues being torture, secondly, the use of military commissions, and third, the indefinite detention of people at Guantanamo. Ashcroft played much less of a role than Alberto Gonzalez, the president's attorney. It was Gonzalez who was really, in my view, a key player here. And focusing on just one of those three aspects, the key document he wrote was January 25th, 2002, and that said we should not apply Geneva to the people picked up in Afghanistan and taken to Guantanamo. And the reason he did that is remarkable, and it really is why I say that Gonzalez and his legal memos paved the road to Abu Ghraib, because what he said in that memo is, look, if we apply Geneva, then we might be subject to war crimes prosecutions under United States law, the we being the president on down. And war crimes prosecutions apply to people who violate the Geneva Conventions. And so Gonzalez says, someone coming down the line may say we're treating people inhumanely. In other words, it's in their heads already that they're going to treat people inhumanely and coercing them. And he says that. He says our interrogation will be limited by Geneva. And someone's going to come around and say we might be charged with war crimes. Well, what's the best way to defend ourselves against war crimes? The best way is to simply say Geneva Conventions don't apply. Therefore, we can't be charged with violating Geneva Conventions. Therefore, we can't be charged with war crimes. The point is that it's Gonzalez who opens the door to saying we can treat people inhumanely, we can do it outside of law, and that is what eventually got transferred from Gitmo, Guantanamo, over to Abu Ghraib when we so-called Gitmoize the prisons in Iraq. So this guy, to me, has nothing to do with law and everything to do with abuse and torture of people around the world.
Michael, you just touched on the reason, as reflected in these memos, why the White House was so worried about the Geneva Conventions. And just to clarify one more time, it wasn't really about the Geneva Conventions per se. They were more worried about a domestic U.S. law.
I think that's right. I mean, Geneva really says that you can't treat people inhumanely. U.S. law then says anyone who violates that provision of Geneva can be tried for war crimes in the United States. So Gonzalez is looking at this, knowing, obviously, this is January 25th, 2002, knowing they're probably already treating people inhumanely and that they're worried about war crimes prosecutions. They have to give a cover to the guys actually abusing people and torturing people. And so what they do is the cover is, let's just say Geneva doesn't apply, and therefore we can't be prosecuted criminally.
Just to give one example of media skittishness around the Gonzalez story, one of the Gonzalez memos dubs certain parts of the Geneva Conventions quaint. The New York Times mentioned that quote, the quaint quote, in a November 11th report that ran with a sidebar including the entire quaint passage. Though the Times got the story right, the next day it ran a correction, skittishly apologizing for not including the entire quote twice in the previous day's paper. Elsewhere in the coverage, in a November 11th column on WashingtonPost.com, Dan Frumkin surveys coverage of Gonzalez and finds most top media outlets began their reports by stressing Gonzalez's Hispanic ethnicity and his closeness with the president rather than his controversial legal views. What are your thoughts about the Gonzalez coverage overall?
Well, I think that the coverage has been awful, absolutely awful. I mean, the two main points being he's Hispanic, and secondly, he's close confidant of the president. and third, probably his humble beginnings, saying he's someone who we should make attorney general. Unfortunately, and very unfortunately, the coverage reflects what seems to be a growing position in the Democratic Party. So there was an article in the New York Times saying the Democrats, while they may ask some hard questions or may look at Gonzales, essentially his confirmation is going to go through, and they're saving their powder for when they get a right-wing guy in the Supreme Court, and they want to oppose that. To me, it's a combination of the coverage and an utter failure of the Democrats to recognize what's going on here. What we're doing is we're basically elevating a guy who took us off the page of Geneva and put us on the page of torture. That's what we're doing. We're rewarding somebody who went outside the law and outside the bounds of what we consider civilization in our society. Just remarkable to me, and remarkable to me that that isn't the focus of both the coverage in the papers as well as of the Democrats. Even if the Democrats were to lose this fight, this is a fight that is about core values in our society and about the rule of law.
Though you've been quoted as a critic of Gonzales in several news stories, perhaps more in international media than in U.S. media, you recently tried to place an op-ed column about Gonzales in a number of newspapers around the country. Tell us about that.
Well, I wrote an op-ed that really went through this memo and said, what are we doing here elevating someone who was involved in promoting abuse that led to torture at Abu Ghraib? And I sent it to really scores of media outlets, the usual ones that I sometimes get published in, the less progressive ones that I don't get published in often. But I usually get my op-eds picked up. I never even got back a response, not even one, nothing, blank. Nobody was willing to take it on. No one was willing to frontally take on Gonzales and even print a strong opinion with it, maybe an alternate opinion. So we're really talking about a silencing of dissent on this particular nomination, and it's not just in the media. You know, when you saw people like Senator Schumer come out after his nomination saying, well, I think the words to the effect that it's probably going to be okay, you just have to say to yourself, has our country gone just mad? Has it just gone mad that we can look at pictures of Abu Ghraib, trace it back to the White House, and then say, elevate this guy?
That was Michael Ratner speaking with Counterspin Steve Rendell in 2004. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith. Welcome to a third program where we look into claims Earth will experience rapidly rising seas and superstorms in the coming decades. Will we experience serious sea level rise during our lifetimes? How about storms bigger than anything in recorded history? All this is suggested by a controversial new paper published in March by an international team of scientists, and that was led by the famous former top NASA climate scientist, Dr. James Hansen. The short title of the paper is Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms. To get another opinion, I've contacted Dr. David Archer. David is a professor in the Department of Geophysical Sciences at the University of Chicago. I learned a lot from his excellent book, The Long Thaw, How Humans Are Changing the Next 100,000 Years of Earth's Climate. David also helps moderate the scientist blog called Real Climate. David Archer, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks to be back.
What was your role in this Hansen paper? Could you explain what a reviewer or a referee is?
Yeah, typically, traditionally, you submit a paper to a journal and the editors solicit some reviews and look at them and, you know, you get to see them yourself and it helps you to re-improve the paper and the editor uses them to sort of decide whether to publish the thing or not. This paper was published in a sort of a new online kind of format where the editors did solicit reviews from a few people, myself included for this one, but it's also open so that anybody who wants to can leave a comment. So this paper got a comment trail that was just incredibly long. Lots of people putting in comments, some of them useful, a lot of them kind of nuts.
Okay. Well, in your book, The Long Thaw, you wrote about polar ice melt that would take thousands of years. And now the paper by the Hansen Group suggests melting could happen much faster. What is your reaction?
Well, even 10 years ago when I did The Long Thaw, it was pretty clear that there have been instances of sea level rise in the past, like the Heinrich events, which the current, even the generation today of ice sheet models can't really simulate or explain. So I always sort of expected that as we understood how ice sheets behave better and as the models improve, our, you know, expectation of how long it would take for them to collapse would get faster. So I'm not at all surprised by this, actually.
And can you help us understand the doubling time argument made in this new scientific work?
Yeah, so the simple view would be to say that the rate of an ice sheet melting is just going to be driven by whatever temperature it's at. So that would be a sort of linear response that, you know, 1 degree of warming might get you this much of a melting rate or 2 degrees might get you that much. But what Hansen is proposing, and this is not totally a new idea, is that the act of the ice sheet melting may enhance the conditions for its own melting so that it would, once it starts to go, it would be a runaway process. So the way it works is that the meltwater from the ice sheet runs into the surface ocean around the ice sheet, and it's fresh, so it's buoyant, less dense than the seawater that it's running into. So it acts to stratify the water column so that the surface of the ocean around the ice sheet gets colder as the ice sheet is melting, but then there is heat that's sort of trapped a few hundred meters down below the surface, and that warming of the subsurface water is in contact with the grounding line of the ice sheet, so it makes the ice sheet go even faster. So these Heinrich events that happened during the last ice age, they occurred kind of embedded within these abrupt climate changes called Dansgaard-Oeschger events. So there would be like 3 or 4 oscillations of temperature in Greenland from these Dansgaard-Oeschger events, and they would get more and more extreme. And then finally, at the coldest cycle of the whole envelope of cycles, that's when the Laurentide ice sheet would suddenly collapse and dump vast amounts of rocks, ice-rafted debris on the seafloor. So it was always weird. Why would this thing melt down when it's cold? You'd think an ice sheet would melt when it's warm. But Hansen is getting indications of this mechanism both from 3 different sources. One is from climate models today. Another is from observations of the real ocean today. And the third is looking at paleoclimate reconstructions. And it's kind of the raggedy edge of all of those different kind of modes of learning about the world. The ocean models that we have, and the one that he uses in particular in this paper, probably overestimate mixing in the ocean. So when you dump fresh water into it in the model, you probably don't get as strong a response as you would in the real ocean, because mixing doesn't happen as quickly in the real ocean. There's mixing for numerical reasons. Then the other part of the modeling story would be the ice sheet model, but there isn't an ice sheet model that we can, you know, tickle the grounding line with 2 degrees warmer water and watch it collapse. That's beyond our capabilities yet. So the modeling is kind of like half there. And then for the observations, there is evidence for sort of an anomalously cold patch around Greenland that may be part of our weird omega block weather in this country, possibly. And there's also this weird thing that the sea ice in the Antarctic hasn't been decreasing as much as the models had been predicting that it should. So it might be changing because of greenhouse gases, or it might be changing because of the ozone hole. But you put both of those things in the climate models and you don't get the sea ice persisting in Antarctica the way it has been. And so Hansen is suggesting that it's due to runoff from the Antarctic ice sheet, which is stabilizing the water column there and keeping the sea surface temperatures sort of anomalously cold. And then there's reconstructions from paleo data. The last time the climate of the Earth was sort of analogous to today was 120-some thousand years ago, a time called the Eemian, the last interglacial time. There's evidence for a period of abrupt sea level rise during this time, which he's also kind of incorporating into this story. The really astonishing thing about the modeling results is when you dump this fresh water into the high latitudes, you get this huge cooling in the high latitudes. And maybe we haven't seen that before because nobody's ever dumped this much fresh water into an ocean model before, but really, really strong effect. And the impact of that is to make the planet stormier, because you're making it colder in the high latitudes, and so the temperature difference between the low and high latitudes gets sort of temporarily exaggerated as the ice sheet is in this process of melting down and collapsing.
All sorts of fascinating things in what you just said. Now, I wonder, is it too early to say that these possible changes to ocean currents in the North Atlantic are responsible for that storm track that kept blasting the United Kingdom during the winter, or the recent cold spell that hit the east of North America while the west has been roasting?
Well, there is this weird omega block thing that climate scientists are talking about or trying to learn more about. You know, it's sort of like traditional, you know, meteorology more than climate science, a blocking event. And so it's not a kind of thing that a lot of climate scientists have thought about a whole lot. But between the so-called polar vortex winter and then other things that have happened, you know, more recently, there seems to be this sort of blocking pattern. And so, you know, one possibility is this persistent and growing cold patch that's been documented by my colleague Stefan Ramsdorf off of the east coast of the U.S. But there's also this weird high temperature, they call it the blob, this thing of water off of the Pacific Ocean, off the west coast of sort of Canada. So I don't know. It's kind of in turmoil, it seems like, the opinions on what's causing this strange weather, if it's, you know, even anomalous.
Well, along those lines, one of the critics of this paper is Kevin Trenberth from the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And he raises with me one of several issues is the lack of recognition in this paper of the role of ENSO, better known to the public as the cycle of El Niño and La Niña. Can Hansen reach the conclusions he does without taking ENSO into account?
Well, I mean, Trenberth is more of a climate modeler than I am. I don't actually do climate modeling myself, so I will certainly take his opinion very seriously. I don't have an idea, though, how El Niño could affect, you know, the ice sheets melting. It seemed like the main point of this paper is this positive feedback thing, where once the ice sheet starts to melt, it just sort of slips like somebody falling in a slippery bathtub. You know, once you start going, you can't catch yourself. And I don't know how El Niño would affect that. He talks a lot about sort of heat transport and the bipolar seesaw, that what happens in one high latitude affects what happens, you know, at the other high latitude, like a sort of temperature seesaw. But I don't know how El Nino would fit into that. Maybe he has ideas that I just haven't thought of. I have no idea. But I don't see where it, you know, undermines what Hansen is going for. You know, this Hansen paper is so wide in scope that it's just presents a huge sort of target cross-section for criticism. If I were doing it, I would have cut it way back and kind of simplified and just, you know, one thing at a time. But this paper is like shooting the moon.
Well, maybe really there's amazing. Three papers in there, really.
Oh, easily.
Yeah. How did the discussion go on the blog you helped moderate, Real Climate? Was there criticism there or about the process of publication or the conclusions?
You know, I don't really moderate that site. I just occasionally, you know, contribute something. My sense from talking to people, you know, I'm pretty enthusiastic about this paper, and so it comes up in conversation a lot when I'm, you know, talking to climate people about, you know, what's up. And I think my enthusiasm for it is on the strong end of the spectrum. It seems like there's a lot of criticism of the paper, but, you know, I view it as just, think of a scientific problem that you're developing a model, and eventually the model will give you a perfect simulation and totally answer the question that you're after. The best scientist in that process is going to get to that understanding, you know, first, when the model is still kind of raggedy and you have to be clever about what questions you're asking it and think really hard about what the model is doing right and what, you know, you can't rely on because it's all, you know, kind of raggedy still. You know, that's the genius of this paper.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, climate scientist and author, Professor David Archer from the University of Chicago. Well, yes, the paper from Hansen brings out the possibility of superstorms this century, larger than anything we've seen. How would that work, and do you agree this could happen?
There's a figure in the paper. It shows the jet stream. It shows the east-west velocity of air as a function of altitude and latitude. And you look at the present-day simulation or the global warming simulation without this ice sheet melting thing going on, and you got these two jet streams that are sort of up high in the atmosphere, and they don't really reach down very much. But then panel B of this figure shows where he's doing this freshwater addition from a purported ice sheet meltdown event, and you get this intense cooling in the high latitudes, which makes the temperature gradient stronger. And you look at the little blob of the jet stream on there, and it's like a drip from a kitchen faucet that's sort of dripping down. You see these velocities, and they sort of drip down all the way to the surface. So it's as though the jet stream is kind of, you make it just a little bit stronger, and suddenly it's starting to reach all the way through the atmosphere and down to the surface. So there's a lot of words in the paper describing, and he says that his initial motivation was reading these geological reconstructions of Eemian time from the Bahamas. And he says that with stronger trade winds, there's just the Bahamas are just getting hammered by these really, really big waves, long period waves that build up across the ocean. So there are various kinds of geological deposit passing on the claim that they were caused by, you know, like a boulder was pushed up by huge waves, couldn't get there any other way, or something called run-up deposits where sand kind of gets shoved up onto the beach by really strong waves and maybe strong storms. So the evidence for really strong storms is sort of twofold. One is the results from the climate model when he doses it with huge amounts of fresh water, and the other are these sort of geological deposits. And, you know, like I said, it's all kind of raggedy edge of what we can see from these various methods now. So what's cool is putting them all together and getting a coherent picture. It kind of strengthens all the pieces. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. That being said, when I reviewed the paper, I said, you know, you should leave out these boulders, man. Just concentrate on the ice sheet melting positive feedback and keep it simple and sort of think about one thing at a time. And he did reorganize the paper. He totally reorganized how it was laid out and makes it much easier to understand. But he stuck to his guns, and you know, reading the finished version, I can see why he did. It is kind of a masterwork of synthesis, I think.
Well, and the man is getting older. He may be feeling like he's running out of time.
as are we all.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, this paper is so large, it feels almost like an alternative climate report. Does it contain a lot of new science, or is it an alternative interpretation of work already done?
It contains a lot of new ideas about how things can fit together. There are, for example, ideas about how the Southern Ocean controls the CO2 concentration of the atmosphere, which is a topic that I worked on and kind of gave up because nobody has been able, myself included, to figure out how to make a model of the ocean carbon cycle that actually can accomplish getting the CO2 down to the low level that you find during the glacial time. But it is very closely correlated with temperature changes in the Southern Ocean. So Hansen says, okay, there's got to be some link between the Southern Ocean and the CO2 concentration. So, you know, here's how this all would work. And, you know, I'd personally like to see it if somebody could, you know, actually describe mechanistically how that works. I'm sure an ice sheet modeler would have the same response to the paper that, boy, you know, it's cool to see how it could all fit together, but it'd be better if, you know, we actually had all the I's dotted and T's crossed and understood all, you know, all the pieces that go into this synthesis.
So if the 2 degree C safe limit, as agreed at the Paris Climate Talks, is actually dangerous, as this Hansen-led paper concludes, where do we go from here?
Well, I would have never called 2 degrees safe. I would very carefully have not ever said that, because 2 degrees is warmer than the Earth has been since agriculture, you know, or even our species, maybe. So 2 degrees to me always felt like bridge engineers selling you a design for a bridge that is not really all that safe, but they think it's all you can really afford. And actually, in Paris, they said 1.5 degrees. I'm not sure exactly what the target is now. Maybe everybody's a little bit vague. But so 2 degrees we could get to by cutting a few percent per year, kind of to where by 2050 we're sort of 80% done releasing carbon. Limiting it to 1.5 degrees, which we've already released enough carbon to get us to 1 degree now, so 1.5 is not that much further off. And given the fact that we are, you know, getting past any sort of, we're not like cutting our emissions at all anyway, really much, it sort of seems to me that eventually what we're talking about is scrubbing CO2 from the atmosphere, which can certainly be done. It would just take energy and the will to do it and a place to put the CO2. And if that happens, the U.S., as we are responsible for a quarter of that excess CO2 in the air, we're going to get handed a big bill, and I personally feel like we kind of deserve it.
So, David Archer, what are you working on these days?
Well, I've got a paper submitted to Climatic Change that says that we were really lucky that the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere in the year 1750 was as high as it was. The CO2 in the atmosphere in the natural state is a very delicate balance of fluxes into and out of the planet. So if the sun had been just a little bit, just a few percent brighter, or if we had come to sentience, you know, 500 million years later in Earth history, or if we were just a few percent closer to the sun, the CO2 concentration could have been lower than it turned out to be. And if that had happened, the climate changes that we're seeing now would have happened earlier in time. So if it had been 1/10 of the actual value, the climate changes that we're seeing now that are arguably motivating us to go to Paris and agree to try to talk about this could have happened back in Svante Arrhenius' time in 1896 when he had a kind of wild idea about climate sensitivity, but it would have been much harder to deal with in that case. So the natural CO2, it kind of like provided a fuse that you light the fuse when you discover coal, and then it burned for 200 years before the bomb went off. And it could have been a shorter fuse, so we were really lucky.
It doesn't feel so lucky right now, but do tell our listeners about your free online climate course. How's that going?
It's great. I have two of them now. The second one is kind of an additional thing. So the main one is on Coursera.org. It's called The Science and Modeling of Climate Change, and they start a new cohort of students, I think, every month. So there are online models, and you get to interact with other students. There are peer assessment assignments and discussion forums. And So far, well, last time I checked, about 50,000 people had signed up for these classes. For free online MOOCs like this, the percentage of people that actually do the work and finish is never very high, and that's true for mine too, but a lot of people are doing it, and it's really very satisfying. The second one is a Python programming course that I just launched a few months ago for climate science.
I have no idea what Python is.
Oh, it's a programming language. It's all the rage now among young people. It's free, and it's got all these packages, so you can do all these fancy plotting, and it's not fast like Fortran, so you can't use it for actual climate global circulation models, but it's great for, you know, just doing little things.
So, as we wrap up, David, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Stay cool. Stop burning CO2. We can do this. I mean, it seems hopeless sometimes, but if it had just turned out that if we were just running out of coal now, if it had turned out that the planet just didn't have as much coal as it turns out to have had, it wouldn't be an energy problem. We're very smart about coming up with ways of you know, making money. It would just be a business opportunity. So in my mind, the climate problem, the only difficulty here is making the decision.
We've been speaking with Dr. David Archer, the well-known climate researcher and professor at the University of Chicago. David has several books out, including The Warming Papers, The Scientific Foundation of the Climate Change Forecast, and The Global Carbon Cycle from Princeton University Press. You can read many of his posts in the science blog Real Climate at realclimate.org. Find links to David's work, including videos, in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. David, thank you so much for helping us out again.
This has been great, Alex. Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
The group of scientists led by James Hansen have explored the extreme possibilities of climate change this century. I'm not qualified to judge the science, but I do disagree with one of Hansen's solutions, which is nuclear power. I'm going to talk that over with one of the greatest anti-nuclear activists in America, Michael Marriott. Why is the world's most famous climate scientist helping out America's biggest electricity producer, Exelon? And why is James Hansen trying to get the people of Illinois to subsidize Exelon's dangerous old reactors in Illinois? Even stranger, why did the death of environmentalism guy Michael Schellenberger suddenly pop up with a new front group called Environmental Progress Illinois? Who is the billionaire funding all that? And why did Hansen join the board? Questions, questions. And for decades, I've relied on the nonprofit Nuclear Information and Resource Service, the NIRS, to get answers on nuclear power. The group was formed in 1978. Michael Marriott has been its executive director since 1985. Due to health concerns, Michael stepped aside for the new director, Tim Judson. But thank goodness that doesn't mean Michael has shut up. Without him, I would never have known about the nuclear swamp in Illinois and Hansen's questionable connections there. Michael Marriott, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us about the reactors, technically the reactors that James Hansen wants to save.
Well, sure. And let me give you a little bit of the backstory here. Exelon is the nation's largest electric utility, having recently taken over the local utility in the Washington, D.C. area, Pepco. So it was the nation's largest nuclear utility, owns more nuclear reactors than any other, but now it's the nation's largest electric utility, period. However, they have several reactors, older reactors, located around the country, but especially in Illinois, which was their original home base, that are uneconomic. In other words, the power they produce costs more than they can get for the power. And that's because there's competition. And the competition is coming in Illinois from both natural gas and especially from wind power that's mostly located not in Illinois, but located in Iowa and Kansas and the rest of the Midwest, which are all big wind power states. So Exelon has been, for at least 2 years now, been threatening to close some of its reactors unless they get additional subsidies, either directly from ratepayers in the form of higher rates or from taxpayers in the form of some sort of legislative mandated subsidy. Now, we look at these threats, of course, as opportunities rather than threats. We think they should close these reactors, and we wish they'd act on these threats. But, you know, what they're really doing is just trying to gouge Illinois residents.
Yeah, but the reactors that they have, are these the same GE Mark I reactors with the holes in the bottom that helped the Japanese Fukushima reactors melt down?
Yeah, several of them are Fukushima clone reactors, GE Mark I. Two of the most threatened reactors are at a location called Quad Cities, which is on the Illinois-Iowa border. And then another one is at Clinton, which is mid-state. It's a newer reactor. It's a GE Mark III, I believe. So it has some improvements over the older GE reactors, but it's the same fundamental, what's called a pressure suppression containment design that failed at Fukushima and is actually, and most people don't realize that, this is not that different from the containment at Chernobyl that failed, which also used a pressure suppression design. People think Chernobyl didn't have a containment. In fact, it did have one. It just wasn't very good. So, yeah, some of these reactors of that design, and these are old reactors. Clinton is the newest one by far. It came online in, I think, 1987. But the other reactors that Exelon has been having problems with, and not only in Illinois, but also in New York and some other states, are mostly 1960s and 1970s vintage reactors.
So what did James Hansen do?
Well, see, this is where it gets interesting, because Exelon really has no arguments on its side for wanting these subsidies, other than greed. They can close these reactors, and clearly there's enough power available to meet Illinois needs because it's already there. And it's underpricing Exelon's reactors. So the power isn't really needed. The cost of the power from the reactors is more expensive, as I mentioned, than the alternatives, so that's not really a good selling point. So the only selling point they have is carbon emissions. And, of course, nuclear reactors are low-carbon sources of electricity. They're not carbon-free, and the nuclear fuel chain, if you want to, you know, if you look at it as a holistic system, it is certainly not carbon-free. There's substantial carbon involved, much more than renewables, which and efficiency, which we believe should replace these reactors in Illinois and elsewhere, should and could, and in fact in Illinois especially, already are replacing them through wind power. So the carbon emissions is the only argument they have, and they're arguing that Illinois can't meet its clean power plan obligations if these plants close, which is almost certainly untrue. But for Dr. Hansen, you know, this just seems like such a stretch for him to argue that these right now three reactors in Illinois are somehow essential to meet the demands of climate change, because they're not. You know, unfortunately, you know, and I have a lot of respect for Dr. Hansen. I was writing my first piece on climate change and nuclear power. I was actually writing it the day he was in Congress for the first time, testifying about climate change and warning the world that we have to take this seriously. And so I actually included him in the article I was writing at the time. You know, this was back in the 80s. You know, I'm not going to argue I'm much more prescient than the next person, but I was pointing out then that this was going to be an opportunity for the nuclear power industry to try to revive based on climate. And, of course, that's instead of trying to revive, they're trying to merely exist in Illinois, because we're talking about old reactors. But, you know, it's just ludicrous to claim that the fate of the planet depends on these reactors in Illinois and their emissions, especially when their power, A, isn't needed in the first place, and B, can be replaced with more wind, more solar, more storage, more smart grids, and all the other technologies of the 21st century that are, you know, really how we're, later in the century, how we're going to be getting all of our power, and, you know, the time to be moving toward that faster is now.
You know, I read Hansen's book, Storms of Our Grandchildren, and there's a lot of great stuff in there about the climate. I learned a lot about the climate from it. But he again pushes reactors there. But there he's talking about Generation 4 reactors, a new brand of reactor which actually doesn't exist yet, but he thinks will be safe enough that we can go forward. It's a long stretch from that to go back to these 1970 reactors, a couple of which have already blown up, and say, yeah, we need to keep those going too.
Right, exactly. And that's the most disturbing thing about what's happened and about Hansen and Michael Schellenberger, who you mentioned earlier, sort of teaming up in Illinois, because Hansen has, in fact, been espousing Generation 4 reactors all along and urging environmentalists to support these Generation 4 reactors. Now, as you said, they don't actually exist, which is true. And we don't support them anyway because they, you know, we think they all have their own flaws, different from the flaws of the current reactors, but they all, you know, have their own flaws. So we see no reason to pursue them because the alternatives are available. But to have Hansen go back on what he was saying, the whole concept of safer reactors, you know, he seemed to at least understand that the existing nuclear reactors are not adequate. And when you go back to the kinds of reactors we're talking about here, these General Electric reactors that already have, you know, failed so dramatically, on, as we all saw on our TV screens 5 years ago, that is a real change. And it's a very disturbing change because it means that he's really not understanding the nature of the risks from nuclear power. And in Illinois in particular, not understanding the realities of what's been happening in that state over the past 2 years with Exelon's, you know, constant lobbying for bailouts and subsidies, which is, you know, really, I can't put it any other way. It's really more a matter of greed than anything else.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Let me give you a break for a second while I tell you about my own experiences with Michael Schellenberger and Ted Nordhaus. They were originally funded by the Nathan Cummings Foundation, who were famous for products like Sara Lee. And they started that Breakthrough Institute in California. The institute, it turns out, was just an office in a plaza in El Cerrito, California. Michael and Ted appointed themselves as senior fellows, which was kind of an abuse of the common understanding of that word, usually reserved for people who had good academic standing and a lot of production in life, and these guys didn't. Michael's kind of a publicist, and Ted was a pollster. So now Schellenberger and Nordhaus's Breakthrough Institute has Rachel Pritzker behind it. She's the chair of their advisory board. And this Pritzker family has 11 billionaires in it with a combined worth over $30 billion. And on their website, the group Environmental Progress Illinois, which Schellenberger set up, acknowledges that they're funded by Rachel Pritzker. And incidentally, James Hansen is also on that board of that little group, and I wonder if he's paid to be there, but that's another question. So why did Schellenberger suddenly pop up in Illinois? He's a California guy. What's he doing there involved in this fight? And it turns out that the Pritzkers and the founders and CEO of Exelon, they rub shoulders all the time because the Pritzker family is so deep into Illinois politics. It's one of the most powerful families in Chicago. One of the current billionaires is Penny Sue Pritzker, who's the U.S. Secretary of Commerce. They've just been going at it together for a long time. And so what we're talking about here is kind of a billionaires club who seem to have engaged a publicist and a famous climate scientist to see if they can get some more money for their old reactors.
Well, actually, that's very interesting because I didn't know that. I didn't really know the source of Breakthrough's funding. I just know that Schellenberger has always said he doesn't take money from the energy industry, and he's been pretty consistent on saying that, so I've believed him on that. But now, yeah, hearing that, I can see why he doesn't need to take money from the energy industry. Yeah, I mean, it was quite a surprise to see them come into, you know, what is really a local battle and that has to do, you know, with more than just what it seems on the surface because, you know, the Illinois state budget is a mess. I mean, you know, things in Illinois frequently are a mess at the legislative level and at the state budgetary level. And that's, you know, part of the problem here is that these issues get drawn into larger issues in the state. But the reality is that Exelon has, for 2 years now, been saying that it needs subsidies to avoid closing uneconomic reactors. And actually, the reactors that they cite have changed over this period. 2 years ago, they were saying that the Byron reactors were particularly threatened. Well, then an investigation revealed that the Byron reactors were actually making money. So they went to Quad Cities. So, well, those are the ones that are failing. You know, we really don't know what to believe about from Exelon, whether these reactors are in fact unprofitable or not in the first place, because they don't provide the kinds of details that would make, you know, outsiders understand that. And B, why should Illinois ratepayers or taxpayers pay extra for their electricity just because it's nuclear, which is really what Exelon is asking for? And it doesn't make sense. And again, the only way you can make that argument, the only way you can frame it if you're on that side is, well, it will help save the climate. You know, I'm not going to argue that keeping those reactors running would be better from a climate perspective than replacing them with a coal plant, you know, for example. You know, nobody's going to make that argument, but that's not the choice we have before us. We have a choice of maintaining the status quo, which is a combination of wind and gas, and sort of slowly moving more and more toward wind, which is the trend, and away from gas, which we would like to see. We don't support gas. You know, we don't support fossil fuels at all, which, you know, is the other side of the choice, is putting up more solar and more wind in the state, which the state could use. That provides jobs, provides industrial activity, you know, helps build the economy. And so it's something that the state could use anyway. So, you know, their argument just falls apart, you know, especially when you realize that the amount of carbon emissions we're talking about from, you know, three reactors in the center of the country is, you know, when you look at the grand picture of things, it's pretty minimal.
Yeah, you published about this in an article called How Low Can They Go? That's in Green World Blog at safeenergy.org. And in that, towards the end there, you had to question your own belief in James Hansen, it seems. I mean, all of us have admired him. I continue to admire him as a giant in the climate field. But it shows that even giants can kind of have their blind spots.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, first it's important to remember there is a difference between being a climate expert, which I am not, and being an energy expert, which I'll lay at least, you know, some claim to, not full claim to, but at least some. Dr. Hansen is not an energy expert. He is a climate expert, and it is a big difference between the two. And for a long time, I sort of just chalked his pro-nuclear stance up to that. You know, this is, you know, I should be clear, Dr. Hansen has been pro-nuclear for quite a long time. That part of it is, you know, not new. I mean, he, back in, I guess, 2013, he wrote a letter to the environmental community, an open letter urging all of us to, you know, support these Generation 4 reactors we mentioned earlier. We and the Civil Society Institute, we being NIRS, and the Civil Society Institute organized a response. We had 300-plus organizations signed on to it, explaining why we were not going to take him up on that and offering to provide a venue to debate him on the issue. And he did not reply at all to our letter. Makes me wonder, you know, how serious he was about it in the first place. But over the years, Hansen has gone from someone who's advocating safer reactors and understanding that nuclear power has to be made cheaper because it's not, you know, it's not economically competitive right now, especially new reactors are even less competitive than the existing ones. And he's gone from that to someone who's, you know, advocating continued operations of the oldest and most dangerous reactors in the United States. And is also advocated, by the way, and he's gone to foundations and advocating not funding environmental groups that oppose nuclear power.
Oh, boy.
He's going, you know, he's gone directly to them and saying you should stop funding these groups. And that's not only groups like NIRS, which are, you know, exist to oppose nuclear power, but groups like NRDC and others who have, they're not even opposed to nuclear power. They're skeptical of nuclear power. And he's been doing that kind of thing. And, you know, that sort of goes beyond the pale a little bit, I think, in urging the idea that Illinois citizens who, you know, already have a big state budget on their backs should pay more for their electricity just because it comes from these aging, uneconomic, and really unsafe nuclear reactors. That is an enormous difference. And for him to be, you know, what I consider so wrong on this issue, so out of what I would call mainstream thinking on this issue even. You know, if you read the local press, you know, even the business magazines or the business newspapers like Cranes, they're not supporting Exelon on this. A lot of Exelon supporters in the legislature are finding it difficult to support Exelon on this, which is why for 2 years Exelon has failed to get any of these subsidies. So for him to be that removed from what makes sense for Illinois and, you know, even what makes sense for the climate, because we can do better than these reactors for the climate, makes me question his entire body of work. And I hate to have to say that, to be honest, but it does.
Right. Well, I think we're going to have to leave it at that, Michael. We're starting to run out of time, unless there's anything that you'd like to add quickly as we wrap up.
Well, the only thing I would like to add, and this is sort of a fun little thing, is that our colleagues in Illinois at Nuclear Energy Information Service, NEIS, a little bit different from our group, but same kind of awkward name, recently took the letter that Environmental Progress Illinois sent to the state legislature. That's Michael Schellenberger's group, and Dr. Hansen was signed on to this letter. And they sort of added in their own comments, showing where Environmental Progress Illinois was wrong and why this is a terrible idea to bail out these reactors. And we published that on Green World, on our blog at safeenergy.org. And I think it would be a fun thing for your listeners to go to and take a look at, because it's a really good way to respond to the kinds of, you know, misleading statements these kinds of groups make.
We've been talking with Michael Marriott, the longtime leader of the anti-nuclear group Nuclear Information and Resource Service. You can find them at NIRS.org. And, you know, I'll put links for both groups and the Green World blog and everything we've talked about, really, in my own show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Michael, thank you so much for stepping up again.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith. Again, whether or not we agree with nuclear power as a solution to climate change, that doesn't reflect on the science behind the new paper, Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms. The scientific community is still divided on Hansen's new work. It will take time to evaluate it.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
David Archer mentioned that sea ice is not decreasing in Antarctica in a warming world, as expected in the climate models. That may be a good thing for the climate. We can get answers from a recent feature radio show on the Antarctic science done by Vivian Langford, host of Beyond Zero Emissions on 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia. Here is an explanation by Professor Tony Warby, the CEO of the Antarctic Climate and Ecosystems Cooperative Research Center.
Good evening, everybody. We're back now to the Antarctica show. And Professor Tony Warby is on the line from Hobart. He's an expert on sea ice. And listeners, if you look up ACE CRC, you can watch a fascinating video by Tony. He's the CEO of the Antarctic Climate and Ecosystem Cooperative Research Centre. I'm delighted to have you on the Beyond Zero Emissions show, Tony.
Yes, lovely to be with you.
Oh, great. Thank you. Look, we live in uncertain times. And the work of your cooperative centre is to prepare government and business for the future. I'd like to know how that international cooperation is having results and how urgently you connect the burning of coal, oil and gas with what you see in Antarctica.
Well, I guess the first thing to say is that in relation to the work we do in Antarctica, it is highly collaborative. We work with a lot of different countries down there. There's a lot of international goodwill in terms of the science that we do. It's a very remote place, so it's logistically complicated to get to. And so there is a lot of international collaboration. And many countries really do increasingly understand the value that Antarctica plays to the global community, the importance of the research that is undertaken down there in informing problems that are relevant to the whole globe. While Antarctica may be remote, it actually plays a pretty important role in all of our lives because of the role that it plays in moderating the climate system, because of the climate services that it provides, in particular in the Southern Ocean, through driving overturning ocean circulation by the absorption of heat and carbon dioxide, and the benefits as well as some of the challenges that are being caused by those natural processes. And I guess to go to the last part of your question, we are seeing significant changes in Antarctica. We know that the ice caps both in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere are changing. We know that the Southern Ocean is changing, and there's a clear indication that a significant amount of that change is driven by human activity.
We're in autumn here, and the sea ice is thickening up in Antarctica. It's at its maximum extent in winter, and apparently it turns the dark ocean white, reflecting the sun back into space. So that sea ice, I've been reading about this or listening to your video too, and that sea ice is really our friend in terms of slowing down climate change. In this annual cycle, it reflects a lot of heat back to space. But is it getting less and less each year, like we see in the North Pole, or something different?
So you're absolutely right. Sea ice is a very, very important part of the climate system and a friend, as you put it. So when sea ice forms around Antarctica, and just to put this in perspective, the area of the Southern Ocean that freezes every year and forms sea ice on it is about 20 million square kilometres. And by contrast, the mainland of Australia is about 7.5 million square kilometres. So we're talking about an area of ocean which is almost three times the size of Australia, which in the summertime is just open water, and in the wintertime and by early spring is covered with something like a metre of ice. So when that ice forms, and you can imagine over that area, it's actually a vast volume of ice that forms, it squeezes salt out of the water as it freezes. So you might take the salinity of seawater is 33 parts per thousand. The salinity of the ice which forms from seawater is much less than that. And that means all that extra salt gets squeezed out into the surface of the ocean. It makes the surface of the ocean more salty and therefore more dense. And because it's denser, it's heavier, and because it's heavier, it sinks. And that's one of the main mechanisms by which vertical circulation of the ocean is driven. So most places you go around the world, the ocean currents are horizontal. Around Antarctica and in the Arctic, the same thing happens in the Arctic. It's this formation of sea ice that drives the vertical movement of the ocean. And that's important because the ocean needs to breathe. And so by sending the surface waters down to the deep ocean, you're sending water that's been in contact with the atmosphere, so it's rich in oxygen, it's going down into the deep ocean. And in turn, that overturning circulation brings other water that hasn't been in contact with the surface for a very long time back up to the top, and it helps to replenish the health of the ocean.
Can I just interrupt there? In the video, you said that people have thought before, that Antarctic sea ice was diminishing, just like it is around Greenland and in the north, the Arctic Ocean is getting less, sea ice is getting less every year. And they thought the same was happening in Antarctica, but you've found out that it isn't. So can you tell us that? Because potentially it sounds like a good news story.
So what's happening in the Antarctic is quite complicated.
But make it simple for us, please.
Yes, I'll do my best. So if you look at the whole of Antarctica, then there is a slight increase over time of about 1% per decade. Okay, so it's not very significant in terms of 1% per decade. If you were getting a pay rise of 1% per decade, you wouldn't be very happy with it. So in the context of, you know, of how much the sea ice is increasing, it is very modest. But it is still a very different signal to what we're seeing in the Arctic, where we're seeing declines of 5 to 10%, you know, over similar amounts of time. So what's happening in the Antarctic, though, if you look region by region, there are some areas where sea ice is declining very rapidly, and there are some areas where sea ice is expanding quite significantly. And the reductions in some areas and the increases in other areas are largely balancing each other out to this 1% per decade increase. Now, the thing that is driving some of those regional changes is also complicated, but it's partly due to the wind. So we know that wind patterns around Antarctica are changing. There's strong northerly winds or stronger northerly winds coming into the Antarctic Peninsula region, which is the area south of Chile and Argentina. And because those winds are coming in from the north, they bring more warmth, they bring more moisture. That whole part of both the land as well as the ocean is increasing as rapidly in temperature as anywhere on the globe. It rivals parts of the Arctic in terms of how quickly that area is warming. But there's a compensating change on the other side of Antarctica around in the western part of the Ross Sea. That may not mean much to many of your listeners, but perhaps the area due south of New Zealand.
Yeah.
And that area is actually experiencing more southerly winds, which means colder air is blowing off Antarctica more strongly, more regularly, and it's pushing, it's not only forming more ice when it hits the, when that cold air hits the ocean, but it's also pushing it north as well, which is resulting in increasing sea ice extent. So there are significant changes happening in different parts of Antarctica for reasons that are related to changing wind patterns, which we believe are related to changing effects in the upper part of the atmosphere as well. And that in turn is linked to the whole story around ozone depletion. So, you know, one of the beautiful things about the climate system is everything is linked. And trying to understand or unravel what's driving what and what's changing at any particular time and the reasons behind that and how much of it is part of a natural cycle, how much of it is part of an anthropogenic cycle is what keeps us busy.
Yeah, and as we just talked to Dr. Sue Cook, she said, you know, it's quite new, really. It's just this last 20th century that all of this science has been possible because we couldn't really travel to Antarctica before. And
that is just part of an interview with Tony Warby by Vivian Langford. We just have time for another excerpt from that Beyond Zero Emissions show on Antarctic science. Here Vivian interviews Dr. David Etheridge from the Australian Research Agency, CISRO.
Good evening, everybody. We're back now to the Antarctica show. I know this is the hard question. You're doing the science, but the people who are making the emissions, you know, the industries that are, you know, we've signed up in Paris to lower our emissions, and that seems to be going on completely separately from the research scientists who are telling us quite alarming things. If West Antarctica is melting quite rapidly and now East Antarctica, according to Tas Van Oemen, is twitching, it's got massive implications.
It does. And let's just go back to the research. Maybe a decade ago, most of the concern was around the Greenland ice sheet, actually, because Greenland is much warmer. The ice sheet is much more responsive to temperature. And it was expected, and the early models showed, that maybe there wouldn't have been much ice with a few degree warming. And that would have added sea level in the same way that the Antarctic did. But a program of ice coring there went through what we expected to be regions of no ice from a period of 100,000 years ago or so. But there was ice there. The upshot of that was that the Greenland ice sheet looks to be maybe a little bit more stable than we thought. So the sea level rise that we knew happened 120,000 years ago must have come from the Antarctic. So the next project was to look at, well, the next most susceptible piece of the Antarctic, and that was probably expected to have been the West Antarctic ice sheet, as you said. Now, recent results that we're getting from sectors of that ice sheet, and this is done through work with the University of New South Wales, showing that, in fact, there are extensive parts of West Antarctica that has ice from that warm period of 120,000 years ago. Now, that brings us back to the East Antarctic, because we know then that the East Antarctic must have contributed to some of that sea level. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a bit worrying because we've, as you said, expected the East Antarctic ice sheet to be this big frozen, fairly unresponsive lump. Mm. Now, the ice core evidence is showing, well, maybe that's not the case. It was probably more interactive in that warm period. But also the more recent evidence that we're finding from the Australian Antarctic Program, which is going under the ice sheet and into these essentially chasms below the ice where ocean water is penetrating under the main Antarctic ice sheet and showing that it could actually destabilise the ice sheet through warming and greater sea level. So this great sleeping giant, perhaps, as Dr. Van Ommen was saying, could be awoken, and I think that's now an area of intense research to find out how quickly that could happen and how much actual sea level could be added to from that region of Antarctica.
Well, would you say the melting in Antarctica is irreversible, unstoppable?
I think in our time frame, yes. The long-term evidence, you know, the geological and glaciological evidence of the ice sheets show that they do wax and wane through cold and warm periods. But over our timescales of, let's say, centuries looking forward into the human future, I don't think we can see anything but a reduction in polar ice. It's just a matter of how much can we arrest that reduction. This melting of substantial melting of ice probably is quite a slow process. These are large amounts of ice. They're already quite cold. You have to add a lot of heat to them to get them to destabilize.
That was Dr. David Etheridge from the Australian Government Research Agency, CISRO. He was appearing on Beyond Zero Radio in Australia on May 6, 2016. I haven't done justice to that excellent full-hour program on Antarctic science with three guests from Vivian Langford on the Melbourne Radio Show. Find the program at 3cr.org.au/beyondzero or get a link in my show blog at ecoshock.info. We're out of time. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening. And please join me again next week for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Next week, we'll be talking with the godfather of coral reefs, and this is British artist Ruth Mundy singing about love in the time of coral reefs.
Thank you. these worst things and we decided not to. It was easier not to.
Josh, the narrator, would you say he's the most normal member of his family?
I guess he's kind of the classic observer in the family, that he's surrounded by people that have more personality and more skills and more, you know, just bigger than life characters. And I've kind of always identified with the person who's observing and is actually the one who can chronicle what's actually taken place in time. And I kind of played that role in my family to some degree. I've got I'm the only one, in my opinion, who can be trusted for a historical account of my family whatsoever.
Give me a quick rundown of who the family members are and what's crazy about them.
Well, the grandfather is perhaps most like the narrator in that he's a sane guy who designs and builds sailboats and has a love for the boats and has a love for keeping the family together and just likes to. He likes to build boats for common people. You know, he's not crazy about the way that it's become a sport for the super rich. The father is a Olympic medalist in sailing and is a hard driving. You know, sailing is the bar by which the whole family is living all the time, and he's constantly trying to improve the family business by being more competitive on the water. Drills the kids with all the sailing info growing up. The mother, she is a scientist, she's a physics teacher, and she's obsessed in her own way, but not so much about sailing, but as going about trying to understand the world either through astronomy or physics or whatever, and has an intensity about her, obviously, in trying to solve unsolvable math problems. And then the three kids, you got Bernard, the oldest one, who is just a rebel at heart and can't wait to rebel against the domineering father and get as far away from him as he can. And then you have Ruby, the one who all the sailing wisdom and gifts and whatever that has been distilled through this family shows up in her, and she turns her back on it, which kind of helps trigger the splitting of the family, all of which is narrated by Josh, going back and forth in time, the milder middle child who just wants to fix boats and help people and pull things back together.
He doesn't want to just fix boats. He also kind of wants to fix his family.
Yes, correct. He wants to fix his family. He's trying to find love online, and he's trying to do a lot.
Ruby, I've only met a few people like this in my life, but you don't forget them. Kind of ethereal.
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of person I was trying to capture with her. You know, people that just kind of seem to, you know, walk lightly on the earth, and could do things that weren't quite explainable. You know, that they just somehow seem to stretch reality, and a lot of those people don't seem to, you know, stay alive all that long. You know, it's almost like they're short for their time here. And I was after all that, as well as kind of the child prodigy. We usually focus on their math or their music skills, but you know, why not a sailor? Why not just this remarkably intuitive sailor who could figure out where the wind was going better than everybody else?
Yeah, she's just. I mean, she can just. I mean, the rest of the family is looking at waves and
right.
and trying to figure it. She just knows.
Well, and I've sailed with people that are just a league above, you know, a couple leagues above what I can sail well, but I can't anticipate the pattern of wind shifts and know which side of the course to be on or where to be to catch the next gust. And if you get them to try to explain it, they really can't. It's much more of an intuitive thing.
Poor Josh gets a message from his father saying, I'm bringing you a boat. You're yeah. going to make the boat ready. And we as a family are going to win a race.
Yeah.
Considering they're barely even speaking to each other.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, all of them are. I mean, they're
right.
all...
Scattered.
Scattered.
Yeah. That's the assignment from the first chapter on, that Josh has to transform this old family boat that they designed and make it competitive against modern sailboats, which is kind of an impossible task. And and also unethical if they don't report the changes to the boat to the race officials, because these are all handicapped races, all of which is weighing on Josh. But at the same time, he does see this possibility that the entire family could get together for a reunion race on the boat, and so that's a strong motivator.
It's both a really good idea and one of the worst ideas ever.
I liked having I liked having them in a compact space like that. All their differences, all their realizations, all their secrets. It was going to come spilling out. If it was going to come spilling out, that was the perfect place for it. At least so I felt. And then combining that energy and that momentum with the ebb and flow of a race with wildly fluctuating wind speeds was all kind of thrilling to write. I was so looking forward to getting to that chapter in my mind, you know, to actually write that scene. It was all kind of exhilarating right there, at least for me.
The book is dedicated to your father. So the question I have to ask is, did Dad like it?
Dad is coming up on 90 years old, and he's read it, I think, 3 or 4 times now.
Wow.
he's a big reader, and his recall isn't as strong as it was, but he still picks up more every read through, and he sees the bits and pieces from my youth and so on. And he sees himself in there in glimpses, he's enjoyed it. My sister's fully embraced it. And
does your family still get together periodically and go out and have a family sale with your dad?
Definitely. So when my dad turns 90, we're going to take him sailing on that day. My wife and daughter and sister will be out there. So, yeah.
Wow, that'll be a blast.
Yeah, it should be.
The book is Before the Wind, a novel. I've been speaking with the author, Jim Lynch, and Before the Wind, published by Broad Street Books.
You're listening to Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM, and we had this terrible fire Fort McMurray and in Alberta, and I saw, of course, the news that they said the fire is approaching the Saskatchewan border, as though maybe fires recognize borders, but this is an amazing, powerful, dangerous thing. It's a humanitarian crisis. It certainly raises all the issues about how we handle and live with the environment. Something happened and has been reported in all of our media, but I'm not too happy with the coverage of it so far. The emergency minister of Russia sent a message to Canada and said, we're ready and we have these planes available, and they carry capable of carrying a tremendous amount of fire retardant materials. They, of course, they're veterans of this experience. And I notice, you hate to say it, but in a human, when you have a crisis, a dangerous one like this, it's what involves everybody on the earth. It's like when you have an earthquake, when you have a tremendous fire, it can be rather revealing of strange political matters. They're saying, well, Canada hasn't responded. Well, how about we just say thank you for the offer? If you want to say that we don't think we need any help, that's okay. That's good. But let's acknowledge that a state with whom we're not at war and with whom we share United Nations membership, and occasionally we've helped them out when a boat gets into trouble and they've helped us previous. But this funny Cold War mentality seems to be creeping into how this is discussed. People saying, well, that's, of course, cynical. How, you know something? If they didn't offer, you'd call that cynical. So make up your mind. But the very first thing should be a respectful, kind response. And it shouldn't take 48 hours or 3 days. You say, thanks. We consider that. We're fighting it, and this is what's going on. We know that if you were to have a problem, we would try to help you out. We better more and more reinforce that type of thinking rather than to drift into this situation where if your neighbor's building burns down, you say that's his problem. It can't be that kind of thinking. That kind of thinking has gotten us into wars. And there's creeping into all the discussions of memorials about World War II, such as I was referring to earlier, a kind of racial thinking that, well, that's our enemy. So whatever happens, we don't, you know, we don't share a common humanity, which in fact we do. And I would remind the Americans and the Canadians, but it's very important to remind the Americans on this issue of how they talk to Russians, that when the struggle with slavery was going on, the war against the illegal rebellion by slave owners to protect their right to own slaves, and Abraham Lincoln was leading the fight against them, in the year 1863, Russia sent their warships to New York Harbor and to San Francisco Harbor at exactly the same month in 1863, and then they stayed there. And why? Because the French and the British were friendly, neutral towards the slaveocracy of the Confederacy. And there was talk of their intervening. They said, oh, it's a terrible civil war going on in America. We should probably intervene and break it up. And how would they do it? Of course, primarily by show of naval power. So the Russians put their warships in both those harbors. And by the way, President Lincoln's wife and others went down and led a parade through the city of New York with a band saying thank you to the Russians for providing basically naval support and to as a signal. And what kind of – I mean, a lot of people poo-poo this, but the British were told there's a Russian fleet supporting Abraham Lincoln in San Francisco. There's a Russian fleet sitting in the New York Harbor. So if you have any ideas about intervening on behalf of the slaveholders, you probably ought to think about that. And that was a wonderful deed. By the way, Rimsky-Korsakov was there as a Russian naval lieutenant. This later went home and became a great composer. But at that time, he was just glad to be one of the sailors, I should say. At any rate, the point being, let's look for things that we can support each other with. Let us have Olympics and let us have good neighborly relations and such and stay out of trouble with one another. But I'm not hearing that from Ottawa or Washington.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Maria Luisa Mendonça, Director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Brazil, who examines the forces behind the impeachment of Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff. Panayoti Solkas, a co-founder of the Prison Ecology Project, who talks about how his group fuses the issues of environmental justice and prisoner rights. And citizen activist and four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who discusses his upcoming Breaking Through Power conference in Washington, D.C., and some of the major issues in the 2016 election campaign. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In reaction to rising street violence, El Salvador's leftist president, Salvador Sanchez Cerén, arrested 16 people involved in negotiating a 2012 gang truce that lasted for 2 years and reduced the level of murders. El Salvador is now the most violent nation in Latin America, as two rival gangs, Mara Salvatrucha, or MS-13, and Calle 18, battle each other. But leading experts condemned the arrests as politically motivated and warned of potentially dire consequences. Adam Blackwell, a former representative of the Organization of American States who helped facilitate the negotiations, said, "This is a vindictive sacrificing of the lambs. Most of those people arrested are decent public servants. Truce or no truce, the authorities need a communications channel." The gang truce effectively cut the level of street violence, but then collapsed as promised reforms, such as reducing prison overcrowding, and programs for reintegrating prisoners into communities never materialized. Former President Mauricio Funes was unable to persuade international lenders to provide aid for the reform programs, and private donors were prevented from giving funds after the U.S. declared MS-13 a terrorist group. The government has now embraced an iron fist strategy in mobilizing over 1,000 soldiers and unleashed a shoot-to-kill policy targeting suspected gang members, of which there are an estimated 70,000 in El Salvador. In the early days of the presidential campaign, the growing national opioid epidemic drew public attention to the growing number of addicts in white rural America. Many blamed the spike in heroin addiction on the widespread availability of legally prescribed opioid pain medications. 2 years ago, Vermont's Democratic Governor Peter Shumlin devoted his annual State of the State address to the new full-blown heroin crisis. Deaths in Vermont from opiate overdoses had doubled over the last decade, and the number of people seeking opiate treatment had risen 800% since 2000. At the February meeting of the National Governors Association's Health and Human Services Committee, Committee Chair Governor Charlie Baker, Republican of Massachusetts, said, "The United States represents 5% of the world's population and consumes 80% of the world's opioids. That's fundamentally flawed. When prescriptions are too hard to get or too expensive, addicts switch to heroin." However, the prospect of politicians reining in pharmaceutical sales is a stretch in the halls of Congress. Last year, Big Pharma spent more than $235 million to influence policy outcomes, the largest budget of any lobby group in Washington. New York City special education teacher Jia Li became so angry about Common Core teaching standards that she refused to give students a required test. She had earlier pulled her son out of testing without the support of her union, the United Federation of Teachers, or UFT. Li became well known for her defiant testimony on Common Core before the U.S. Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. She complained that the constant emphasis on testing undermined critical thinking among students and forced parents to raise outside funds to pay for arts and music education. Now, Li is leading a reform campaign in New York City's teachers' union elections on May 26th by challenging pro-Common Core UFT president Michael Mulgrew on a slate backed by the Movement for Rank-and-File Educators, or MOR. Moore, an affiliate of the National Reform Network linked to the Chicago Teachers Union, which waged a successful strike in 2012, promotes a vision of social justice unionism in public education, where educators push against inequality in school districts and fight for more resources in communities of color. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After months of investigations, debate, and street protests by supporters and opponents of Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, Brazil's Senate voted to impeach the nation's first female head of state. Rousseff will now be put on trial over allegations that she violated fiscal regulations by using funds from state banks to cover budget shortfalls in order to continue funding popular anti-poverty programs. Now suspended from office, Rousseff's unpopular vice president, Michel Temer, has taken the reins of power for up to 6 months during the president's impeachment trial. Many of Rousseff's supporters, who benefited from her Workers' Party government's policies that lifted millions out of poverty, believe that the impeachment of the president is in fact a coup d'etat orchestrated by the president's political opponents and Brazil's wealthy elite. Unlike President Rousseff, many of those involved in the impeachment effort are under investigation themselves for crimes such as money laundering, forging documents, and misappropriating public funds. Among those accused is acting President Temer. Internationally known political dissident, linguist, and author Noam Chomsky said after the May 12th impeachment vote, quote, "We have the one leading politician who hasn't stolen to enrich herself, who's being impeached by a gang of thieves." Your reporter spoke with Maria Luisa Mendonça, director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Brazil, and a professor at the University of Rio de Janeiro's International Relations Department. Here, Professor Mendonça examines the forces behind Rousseff's impeachment as she expresses concern for the repression that may now be unleashed.
Yes, I think the first thing that is important to understand is that the reason for the impeachment is a very common practice that several administrations have used. They basically borrow money from public banks to cover expenses with social programs in Brazil. So previous administrations have done this at the federal level, and currently, if we use the same criteria, at least 16 state governors would have to be impeached. So she's not being accused of any corruption charges. At the same time, that the Congress members from the opposition parties that are putting her on trial are the ones facing serious accusations of corruption. The Speaker of the lower house, who now had to step down, he was the one who orchestrated the impeachment process against her. And he's being charged of having millions of dollars in offshore accounts in Switzerland. And the public prosecutors in Switzerland have confirmed that information. So President Dilma actually gave more independence to the federal police to investigate cases of corruption. And I think that's one of the reasons why the conservative parties now are trying to stop the investigations by accusing her of a practice that cannot justify her impeachment.
What are the prospects that Dilma Rousseff will survive this trial and return to office as president?
Well, it doesn't look very good, which is very dangerous for democracy in Brazil and for the whole region. Because even before the vote, the Congress members in the Senate in the lower house have already expressed their opinions. And they didn't even mention the reason for the impeachment. In the lower house, it was a bizarre situation. One after the other, Congress members were saying that they approved the impeachment in the name of God, in the name of their families. One of them praised a former military commander known by performing torture against political prisoners during the military dictatorship. And now what we have, just 5 hours before taking power, the supposed new president is already making structural changes. He abolished, just in 5 hours, the ministers of culture, of communication, of women, of racial equality, of agricultural development, and also the governmental bodies that used to control cases of corruption, that used to investigate those cases. So I think we're going to see a situation of repression against social movements that are protesting against what we see as a parliamentary coup.
Maria Luisa, I have heard that Michel Temer, Dilma Rousseff's vice president, who's now the acting president, may very well implement a neoliberal economic program even before any new national elections are scheduled. How much of a concern do you have that a lot of the programs that lifted millions of people in Brazil out of poverty over recent years that the Workers' Party was in government will now be reversed with this unelected president who's taking the reins of office in the midst of this crisis?
Exactly. He already announced several cuts in social programs, in health care, in education, and he appointed radical, evangelical, right-wing new ministers. For instance, the new minister of science and technology is a religious fundamentalist that doesn't believe in science. The new minister of health just said that, for instance, the problem of Zika virus is because the mosquito is not obedient. So we have this bizarre new cabinet of right-wing evangelicals that are cutting social programs already just in a few days. And what we are going to see probably is more economic instability, more social inequality, and all the gains that we had in the last decade. You know, President Dilma was elected and reelected, and at that time of her reelection, we had the situation of full employment in Brazil. Then right after she got reelected with 55 million votes, Brazil suffered a speculative attack from financial markets, and that was the reason why the economy was destabilized, and because there was no reason. It was different from here in the United States when you had a house bubble and then you had an economic crisis. In Brazil, suddenly we wake up and we have an economic crisis for no apparent reason. So there was a speculative attack against the economy, and at the same time we had a huge campaign from corporate media, and all the TV networks started to call demonstrations against the government and tell people that the only way the economy was going to improve was that if there was a change in government. So it's important for people to understand that we don't have a parliamentary system in Brazil. It's a presidential system. So we cannot impeach a president just because at some point in her term, her popularity is low, or some people don't like her. So we have to respect the result of the election. That's the main point we need to clarify.
That was Maria Luisa Mendonça, director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Brazil, and a professor at the University of Rio de Janeiro's International Relations Department. Find more perspectives on the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A group of activists has brought together two seemingly disparate issues, criminal injustice and the environment, to create the Prison Ecology Project. The effort focuses on those who fill U.S. prisons, mostly poor and people of color, suffer as prisoners and also as victims of environmental injustice. One blatant example they brought to light was how prisoners in a New Orleans parish jail were treated as the levees broke after Hurricane Katrina. The prisoners were abandoned in their cells as the water rose around them before eventually being rescued. The Prison Ecology Project addresses issues such as damage of sewage and industrial waste from overpopulated and underregulated prisons into waterways, threats to listed species by the ongoing construction and operation of prisons in remote, environmentally sensitive rural areas, and environmental justice concerns regarding prisoners, staff, and surrounding communities. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Panayotis Solkas, who was a co-founder of the Prison Ecology Project in 2014. He recently helped develop the Campaign to Fight Toxic Prisons, which is holding a convergence in Washington, D.C. this June. Here, Solkas describes why he has chosen to do this work and what he hopes will come out of the upcoming convergence.
What happened in Katrina was pretty thoroughly documented, and it kind of opened a lot of people's eyes to the climate justice movement, and which I think, you know, in a lot of ways opened up the space to connect social and environmental issues in general. And the prison, the experience of people in that local prison there, I think the Orleans Parish Prison, you know, that experience, I think, really illustrated a piece of what we're talking about, where that people in prison are at a higher risk for, you know, various things, the impacts of climate change, of sea level rise, of temperature changes, what we've seen with the extreme heat cases that are happening across the South, where prisons, a lot of prisons, I'm here in Florida, a lot of prisons in Florida don't have air conditioning. People are just suffering through this hell of being in a giant metal box, basically. And there's been some good reports about that as well. So we've been taking some of the documentation of these various issues. A lot of them are coming out through the environmental justice angle or the prisoner rights angle, and then combining them together and saying, look, there's these overlaps between environmental justice and prisoners' rights, and it's a potential there for really powerful organizing.
Panayotis Solkas, what brought you into this work?
I've been involved with primarily environmental organizing for the last 17 or 18 years, and I was following prison issues as well as environmental issues, and generally sort of separate. There were just things I was interested in, and I got involved with activism through organizations like Earth First and Food Not Bombs and other grassroots, mostly anarchistic type of organizing. And I continue doing organizing through the Earth First Network primarily, and I was an editor on the Earth First Journal. And around the time that people started getting indicted and arrested in what we call the Green Scare, where there was this wave of FBI interest in environmental actions that had occurred over the last, you know, decade and a half or so. And so people that I knew that I was in a similar, you know, social circle with started going to prison and seeing from the inside the experience and in corresponding with people and in learning more about it and various facets, you know, from how crazy expensive phone calls are to, you know, censorship of certain books and magazines and the tensions within prisons. So those things started becoming more present, more real to me, as they are to the millions of people who have family in jails and prisons around the country. I myself have also been in numerous jails throughout the country, so I've seen that side of the so-called criminal justice system on more than a dozen occasions. And I think that after you leave a jail cell, in my experience and what I've heard from other people, there's this kind of heavy obligation of like, just what do I do with what I just learned? You know, even if you were only in there for a day or two, the things that you saw, the people that you met, it's a pretty quick eye-opening experience at just how twisted, you know, this whole system is.
Tell us about this convergence that's happening in D.C. What are the goals and who's coming to it?
Great. June 11th through the 13th, we'll be gathering in D.C. with the convergence is specifically targeting the toxic prison scenario around this country where prisons are the cause of pollution, where people are experiencing, you know, health problems related to being in prison or near prisons. And we have several noted former prisoners who will be participating and support people or family members of prisoners that will be there. One, for example, is Eric McDavid, who is an environmental activist who was put in prison his prison was also a military Superfund site that was known as a toxic location, and it's not uncommon that prisons are built on Superfund sites or near Superfund sites, or former mines, military bases, and that sort of thing. Ramona Africa from the MOVE organization in Pennsylvania will also be there, and one of the keynote speakers, and will be also targeting the Bureau of Prisons' proposal to build a new federal prison on top of a mountaintop removal coal mining site. And so there will be a protest on Monday, the 13th, which will be the culmination of the convergence.
That was Panayoti Solkas, co-founder of the Prison Ecology Project. Learn more about the project and their upcoming campaign to fight toxic prisons convergence by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Citizen activist and four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader's latest book is titled Breaking Through Power, It's Easier Than We Think, which is also the name given to a very special four-day event sponsored by Nader's group, the Center for the Study of Responsive Law, that will take place in Washington, D.C., May 23rd through the 26th. The event, which commemorates the 50-year anniversary of the publication of Nader's first book, Unsafe at Any Speed, is dedicated to exploring ways to mobilize the public to break through the structures of power, holding back democratic solutions to our nation's and world's many crises and conflicts. Each day of the conference, that will be held in the Capitol's historic Constitution Hall, is focused on one of four topics: how it's done, the media, war, and Congress. Speakers engaging on these topics include activists, academics, and authors from a wide variety of disciplines and political perspectives. On the final day of the conference, a new civic agenda will be unveiled to be advanced by citizens in each congressional district across the U.S. Your reporter spoke with Ralph Nader, who talks about the objectives of his Breaking Through Power conference and offers some observations on some of the major issues that have emerged in the 2016 election campaign.
The 4 days are broken down into four categories, and the theme is it's a lot easier to make change than most people think. And some people may say, oh, yeah, prove it. All right, well, day one is Breaking Through Power, How It's Done. And there are 17 groups who've been doing it on small budgets and great stamina by a few people for years. I think the total years worked by these groups is about 800 years. Don't say you can't make change in this country with a small group, especially if it reflects what Abraham Lincoln called the public sentiment, what we call today public opinion. No one in history has brought together more groups on more redirections and reforms for our country under one roof. And that wasn't that hard, because most conventions, as you know, and conferences are single issue. People have conferences on health care. They have conferences on zoning issues. They have conferences on taxes. Well, this tries to get over the silo effect and show that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
What is your hope for any concrete goal to come out of all these luminaries of activism on the whole range of issues, as you just said, breaking the silo? What would you like to see come out of this four-day conference?
Well, one, I'd like these groups to get more visibility and support from around the country. They don't brag very much. Number two, I'd like in an election year to have this be a reassertion of the civil society, without which we don't get good politics. We get terrible politics. And if we're all going to just focus on the candidates until November, and not support public movements, public demonstrations, then we're not going to be able to nourish the election campaign with all kinds of subjects and issues that are being ignored and taken off the table by both the Republican and Democratic Party. The third thing we want to accomplish is to form two groups, one, Voices, which will go and challenged the commercial media and the cable monopolies for not allowing enough serious content. Just look at Saturday morning NBC, CBS, Fox, ABC, and look at the cable stations on Saturday morning and afternoon, and you'll say, why are they using our property this way? We own the public airways. We're the landlord. The TV radio stations are the tenants, and nothing else going on in America. There's no labor channel, no consumer channel, no student channel. I think our expectation levels have been too low, Scott. We have to raise them, because if we don't raise the expectation levels, we don't heed what was said so many years ago by the great abolitionist when he said, power concedes nothing without a demand.
Ralph, you've long railed against the disservice of our corporate media system, especially when it comes to politics and economic issues. Maybe you could name for us what we're seeing unfolding here with especially the Trump phenomenon, where he's gotten billions of dollars of free airtime because it boosts their ratings. And it seems quite clearly profit-driven in terms of how much attention Donald Trump is getting. But how do we fix the media system so they're more driven by issues in the public interest than their short-term, next quarter profit statement?
Well, there are some easy ways. One is to intelligently demonstrate right around a TV station. Usually they have a big parking lot and they have their own building. And when they go on the evening news, 5 o'clock or whatever, they got 300-400 people outside basically saying, let us in. It's our property. You're not covering the local community. You're not covering the state. You're not adhering to the 1934 Communications Act, which requires you to recognize the public interest, necessity, and convenience. And can you imagine yourself, Scott, you're about to deliver the 5 o'clock news, and all of a sudden, 300-400 people are surrounding your two-story building. What are you going to do? Are you going to ignore it? And that's a good educational technique to show people. A lot of people don't realize that the public airways belongs to us, and we're giving it away free 24/7 to very profitable commercial radio and TV stations, unregulated by a supine Federal Communications Commission, battered by a supine Congress, greased by campaign funds from the communication, broadcast, and cable industry, and fearful of their coverage back home if they take them on.
That was citizen activist, author, and four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Find more details and links to the schedule for Nader's Breaking Through Power Conference by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Voting. The final fig leaf. As elections near, voters face the choices before them with something like dread. Donald Trump. Loathed, loud, bellicose, rich as Croesus, and xenophobic. Or the presumptive Democratic nominee, unless Vermont's Bernie Sanders can upend her, Hillary Rodham Clinton, slick as oil, flexible as a slinky, bottled blonde ambition, and wife of the proverbial political animal, Slick Willie Clinton. Both options have eyebrow-raising negative ratings. In a word, it's a battle between nasty versus crafty. Ultimately, the race may come down to who is hated least. Indeed, this election may reveal voters choosing a victor by voting not so much for one, but voting against the other. Trump seems to trumpet his meanness, almost as posting a sign. No Mexicans, no blacks, no broads, and no chinks need to vote for me. Hillary, as co-architect of the prison industrial complex, has shown up in more black churches than the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. She's eaten pork chops, quoted Sojourner Truth, and tried to sing Negro spirituals to lure black voters. Sadly, millions of black voters will opt for Clinton, who helped cause more black pain on a vast scale than any antebellum slave owner. Thank goodness for black youth who, as Black Lives Matter, bucked their parents to raise a burning social issue, mass incarceration. Unlike virtually any constituency in America, we vote for who we find comfortable and demand nothing. Other constituencies demand discreet, clear policies and get them. We vote like children in a grocery store for bright, shiny, glittering things, you know, sugar cereal. If Hillary Rodham Clinton gets elected, it'll be because of black voters rewarding a politician for a policy of repression. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Something known as the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine, which holds that an illegal search, arrest, or interrogation poisons or taints all that follows, and as such, it may not be used in a prosecution. If that is so, what if America's failed and corrupt so-called drug war as poisoned a fruit as possible, born as it was, from political lies, meant to cover state attacks on radicals, especially black radicals? The recent revelations of former Nixon White House aide John Ehrlichman that drugs were used as a proxy to target blacks and hippies should poison all that sprouted from that foul and loathsome plant. The dirtiest of Dick Nixon's dirty tricks. It has led to the explosion of prisons in American life, and the subsequent crippling of millions of families for half a century. The so-called drug war is thus a lie built on a lie, and used by the state to repress, harass, disrupt, and destroy. Yesterday, the prison ran a dog line, where a pooch ran down a line of prisoners waiting to go to yard. It was as ridiculous as it was revealing. For if there are drugs in prison, it's more likely than not that a staff member brought it in rather than a prisoner. No dog lines for staff, though, huh? The false drug war has, like all wars, been far more destructive than it has been creative, and it has corrupted and poisoned all that has been touched by it. It has corrupted cops who have profited from it as well as become drug merchants. It has reduced the Fourth Amendment to shreds, even as it has intellectually corrupted courts, which ignore the Constitution to further a false war on drugs. It has placed black and Latino youth under lifelong suspicion, subjecting them to arbitrary and oppressive searches, seizures, and arrests. It has fueled the boom in the prison industry. A false war, yes, but which has had real life and death effects. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Phenomenon of the 90s defended his position with classic Clintonian doublespeak. He argued that the imprisonment boom that he fathered was done to protect blacks from other blacks. Quote Clinton, how can you defend those vicious gang leaders who sent 13-year-olds into the streets to do their killing? This, in response to Hillary Clinton's venal denunciation of super predators, which gave rise to the greatest imprisonment boom on earth, was defended by Clinton in a way only Bill Clinton could have done. Essentially, he argued, we did it for you. One needs to go back to the tortured prose of the Dred Scott decision to find something so audacious. There, that old slave owner and Chief Justice, Roger Brooke Taney, argued that the Negro was subjected to slavery for his own benefit. I guess great minds think alike, huh? Bill Clinton unleashed the greatest imprisonment boom in American history to protect black folks from black children, you know, the super predators. This is Clintonism. Neoliberalism equals so-called compassionate conservatism for the good of the natives. He didn't do it to employ tens of thousands of rural whites in the containment so-called corrections industry. He didn't do it to create tens of thousands of new state workers who would donate to the Democratic Party for generations. He didn't do it because it gave lower class whites a sense of entitlement and a recession-proof profession. He didn't do it because it was the new way that Democrats governed, tougher, meaner. He did it because he felt black pain. He did it for you. This is Clintonism, wars for profit. Prisons for profit. More jails equal more jobs, right? More cops, more crime. See, it works out, doesn't it?
Hillary Clinton apologized for her choice of words. Bill Clinton, being Bill Clinton, bragged about it. I did it for y'all, he yells. Voting for Clintonism promises more of the same. Hey, good luck with that. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Is there an ulterior motive behind the recent impeachment of Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff? Is there a connection between the NSA's spying of Dilma Rousseff a few years ago and current events? How is Washington likely to benefit from the present turmoil in Brazil? What are the prospects that the Workers' Party can be restored to power, perhaps under the leadership of former President Lula da Silva? Is the Brazilian government preparing a major reversal of gains for indigenous peoples and the environment? On this week's Global Research News Hour, in the wake of the political chaos sweeping Brazil, we speak to a prominent Brazilian-born geopolitical analyst and author, Pepe Escobar, about the deep political geography shaping current events in the world's seventh largest economy. Then we hear an interview with John Aniwanika Shirto about significant behind-the-scenes impacts on indigenous Brazilians. On this week's program, there is a coup going on in Brazil and the current government is illegitimate. A conversation with Pepe Escobar. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 20th, 2016. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, unoccupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Institutional corruption is killing people's trust in our government and our institutions. Neither do Democratic or Republican parties represent the interests of the American people. Elections have become nothing but scripted beauty contests, with both parties ignoring the desires of their own bases. Indeed, America is no longer a democracy or republic. It's officially an oligarchy, and the allowance of unlimited campaign spending allows the oligarchs to purchase politicians more directly than ever. That comes from the article, "This U.S. Government is the Most Corrupt in History," by Washington's blog, posted May 18th. The expectation and demand is clearly that Russia must allow itself to be surrounded by NATO and to do this without complaint, and therefore also without taking military countermeasures, which NATO could call yet more, quote-unquote, aggression by Russia. Any defensive moves by Russia can thus be taken by the West to be unacceptable provocation and justification for a, quote-unquote, preemptive attack against Russia by NATO. That would be World War III, and it would be based upon the same accusation against Russia that the Republican candidate for the U.S. presidency, Mitt Romney, had stated when he was running against Barack Obama, quote, "This is without question our number one geopolitical foe," unquote. Perhaps the West here intends the final solution of the Russian problem. That comes from the article, "NATO Announces War Policy Against Russia, Chilling Scenario of Encirclement," by Eric Zeus, posted May 18th. In 2014, the authors of the report, "The Record of a Captive Commission," concluded that the outgoing Barroso IIEC's trade and investment policy revealed a bunch of unelected technocrats who cared little about what ordinary people want and negotiate on behalf of big business. The reports state that the European Commission had a one-sided relationship with agribusiness on GMOs and pesticides. Far from shifting Europe to a more sustainable food and agriculture system, the opposite had happened as agribusiness and its lobbyists continued to dominate the Brussels scene. The report noted that the industry had been exerting strong pressure to prevent action by the EU on endocrine disruptors and pesticides. Failure to expose and challenge the corruption, lobbying, backroom, free trade deals, and revolving door that exists between agribusiness and decision-making regulatory bodies will result in these corporations continuing to prosper at everyone else's expense. That comes from the article, "Monsanto and the Poisoning of Europe, Open Letter to the EFSA Chief Attorney about Relicensing Glyphosate in the EU," by Colin Todd Hunter, posted May 18th. Obama now is going beyond mere sanctions to real military preparation for an invasion of Russia. On May 12th, Stuart Hooper at 21st Century Wire headlined, "New Arms Race Begins, U.S. Launches European Missile Shield in Romania." So not only is the U.S. placing nuclear missiles on Russia's borders, but it's also placing their anti-missile missiles to destroy outgoing Russian missiles that could be flying in retaliation against America's attack. And then when Russian President Vladimir Putin responds to that type of aggressive move by his roving Russian forces to Russia's own borders to deter NATO's aggression, Obama and his propagandists blame Putin for threatening aggression against a NATO member. That comes from the article Obama Ratchets Up to Invade Russia by Eric Zeus, posted May 18th. On the 12th of May, a massacre was committed in the town of Al-Zara in the southern countryside of Hama, Syria. Women and children were slaughtered by Takfiri death squads branded by the Western media as moderate rebels. Western governments rant and rave about the necessity of military intervention to stop the massacres. This time there was silence. There is no benefit to the perpetrators of neo-colonial warfare and genocide in admitting that the terrorist is NATO, that it is actually the Syrian Arab Army that is fighting terrorism and not the Western military alliance. That comes from the article The West's Massacre of the Innocents in Syria by Gerard O'Kalman, posted May 18th, originally appearing at gerardokalman.org. The American aggression against China continued Tuesday, May 10th, with the invasion of Chinese waters just off the Spratly Islands by an American destroyer as China's limited stock of patience continues to run out. By sending their ships into Chinese territorial waters on the bizarre claim that they are exercising their right of innocent passage and that the United States will fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows, they are, in fact, claiming the right to go anywhere they want, anytime they want. Logic requires that unless these provocations stop, there will be a shooting incident in the near future because there will be nothing else China can do. The thought of what could happen next can only make you shudder. But unless the world thinks hard about that and reacts with the necessary response, this renegade nation, the one nation that roams around the world with a big club, threatening, bullying, and destroying without regard for law, morality, or humanity, will push us all to the eve of destruction. That comes from the article American Aggression Against China, A World Crisis Looms, by Christopher Black, posted May 19th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Brazil's Dilma Rousseff has seen her presidency under siege for the last couple of years. 3 years ago, her personal approval rating stood at 79%. She emerged victorious in the 2014 elections. By July of 2015, following protests over alleged involvement in a corruption scandal, Rousseff's approval rating dropped to 9%, and her disapproval rating stood at 64%. The scandal known as Operation Car Wash involved the state-controlled oil company Petrobras and allegations the company's executives were accepting bribes from certain construction companies in exchange for contracts at inflated prices. Kickbacks would be used to finance electoral campaigns. Rousseff has denied any prior knowledge of the scheme, however. On April 17th, Brazil's lower house moved to initiate impeachment proceedings against President Rousseff over accusations she was manipulating government accounts. These were referred to as crimes against responsibility. The motion passed by a vote of 367 to 137. On May 12th, the Senate of Brazil suspended for a six-month period Rousseff's powers and duties as it deliberates on whether to remove her from office or acquit her for the crimes of responsibility with which she is charged. Vice President Michel Temer has assumed Ms. Rousseff's powers and duties and is functioning as the acting president of Brazil. Many critics, however, are suggesting that this constitutes a coup to serve internal and external powers. One of those critics is Pepe Escobar. Pepe Escobar is an independent geopolitical analyst who writes for RT, Sputnik, and Tom Dispatch, and is a frequent contributor to many radio and TV shows and websites, including Global Research. He's the former roving correspondent for Asia Times Online and has been a foreign correspondent since 1985. He's lived in London, Paris, Milan, Los Angeles, Washington, Bangkok, and Hong Kong, and was born in Brazil. He is, in his writing, he places an emphasis on big power geopolitics and energy wars and is the author of Globalistan, Red Zone Blues, Obama Does Globalistan, and Empire of Chaos. And his latest book is 2030. He joins us now from Ibiza. So thank you very much for joining us, Mr. Escobar.
Thanks, Michael. It's a pleasure to be with you and with everybody else, of course.
Now, we're hearing, if we could just maybe focus, first of all, on the official narrative that that we're being asked to believe, that that Ms. Rousseff has she's being accused of these crimes of responsibilities. What could be paraphrased as creative bookkeeping, and this has instilled outrage on the part of politicians and the broader public, and with demonstrations, and so she is. There was a vote in the lower house which saw her this directed to the Senate, and then there's just this recent impeachment proceeding that's playing out. I'm wondering if that's more or less accurate in terms of the official story, and maybe you could make any corrections there, because I suspect you have some concerns about what's really playing out. So.
Well, Michael, concerns is the euphemism of the century. Let's put it this way. Yes, this is the official story, that Dilma has been accused of crimes of responsibility, which were never proven, by the way. This is what the Senate, in the next 180 days, when they are theoretically examining the merit of the whole question, it's their burden to prove that Dilma actually did some sort of maquillage, as the French say, with a budget. What actually happened, and Dilma has forcibly defended what she's done, these were not even decrees. These were everything that she did with the budget numbers was published in the official journal that comes out of Brasilia every day. So, and what she may have done, if it was masking the real budget deficit, her vice president would be implicated. So he would have to be impeached as well. But the whole point of this very sad, ghastly process, in fact, is related laterally to the car wash investigation that's been going on in Brazil for 2 years now. Corruption inside Petrobras, the state oil giant. Collusion between Petrobras executives, heads of powerful construction companies in Brazil, and politicians, mostly of the Workers' Party. This investigation has some merit, in fact, because the whole Brazilian political system is corrupt. And of course, there was a sort of a criminal cell inside Petrobras as well. But everybody profited from it, not only the Workers' Party in power, but different opposition parties as well. And the politicization of this whole investigation, in fact, from the beginning, it was obvious week after week, the way the judge, a provincial judge in southern Brazil, was conducting the car wash investigation, was taking a cue from the Money Politi investigation in Italy in the 90s, involving the mainstream media from the beginning. So it was basically a process of criminalizing people through mainstream media and only people from the Workers' Party, in fact. And the final target, the big prizes, in fact, two big prizes would be to get Dilma accused of something and to put Lula in jail. So they tried to put Lula in jail 2 months ago. It didn't work. When Lula was more or less kidnapped from his home at 6 in the morning, taking from the to the municipal airport in Sao Paulo, put it in an interrogation room for 4 hours to answer questions that he had already answered before. And they were basically trying to kidnap him and take him to one of Brazil's southern states, which is the headquarters of the car wash investigation. And this sort of kidnapping coup at the last minute was prevented by some Air Force officers that were at the airport at the time. This is something that you will never read in Western mainstream media. The whole story was unearthed by Brazilian independent journalists. And I happened to be there at this fateful day in Sao Paulo itself. And I followed the whole thing practically live. It was one of the craziest political days of my 30 over plus story as a foreign correspondent. And I happened to be in my home country. So this was absolutely amazing. So this was the coup against Lula. Didn't work. In parallel, we had an investigation, sort of investigation, in fact, an impeachment motion that had started in the Brazilian Congress. To give an idea, if you think that the Congress in the U.S. is corrupt, you ain't seen nothing yet in Brazilian terms. It's basically a gigantic lobby of, in Brazil, it's called the BBB. BBB stands for beef, which is the powerful agribusiness lobby. Bullet, which is the very, very powerful private security industry in Brazil and also Brazilian weapons manufacturers. And the other B is Bible. Very, very powerful evangelicals in Brazil, including the former head of the lower house, which was sidelined by the Supreme Court finally a few days ago before the impeachment in the Senate. So we had two parallel processes developing these past few months. The car wash investigation, which had put people in jail, some politicians, some were accused but not in jail yet, and some heads of construction companies. And in Congress, we had this impeachment motion that was fast-forwarded, in fact, by Eduardo Cunha, the former head of the lower house, which runs a political campaign scam or racket inside Congress himself. He is well-known all over Brazil as arguably the most corrupt man in the whole country. So you had this politician running an impeachment motion in Congress against a woman, president of Brazil, that was not formally guilty of any wrongdoing.
There's a saying of the pot calling the kettle black, and that sounds like what you're talking about with Cunha and Rousseff.
Absolutely. And from the beginning, some international observers, not correspondents in Brazil from mainstream media in the U.S. or in Europe, but some observers, some in the U.S., in fact, independent, some Russians, myself included, we knew what this was going on, and we knew that was absolutely crazy that Cunha himself was conducting this whole thing when he should have been in jail. He was found guilty of possessing 11 illegal bank accounts in Switzerland. He was mentioned in the Panama Papers. He was being already investigated for a racket, a ethanol racket of $5 million that he probably got most of it in cash. He was accused by people left and right of receiving bribes in cash from the accusers. And obviously the Supreme Court didn't move against him. Their argument, the Supreme Court, no, we cannot interfere with legislative powers, which is completely absurd because nowadays, everything in Brazil, and in fact, it didn't start today, since the beginning of car wash, the whole process has been politicized. The judges are politicized. The prosecutors are politicized. The fact that only politicians from the Workers' Party were being accused, indicted, you name it. And in Congress and the Senate, the same thing. The base that's used to support the Workers' Party in both Congress and the Senate, they, when they saw an opening that they could have the vice president, which comes from another political party, the PMDB, in power, They defected from government. And that's why Dilma keeps telling that she was betrayed and these people are usurpers. They are usurpers.
Could you talk about the you mentioned the Operation Car Wash earlier.
Yeah.
Do you see any connection with – because – any connection with what the charges of the NSA spying going back to 2013, spying on your cell phone and on other good government officials?
Of course. And this is something that you never get from CNN, from the New York Times, Washington Post, etc., and most of the European papers for that matter. The origin of Car Wash is the NSA spying on Petrobras and on Dilma personally, including her cell phone. And Edward Snowden at the time, and even later, he kept quipping that the Brazilians should know how to encrypt their technology, especially vis-a-vis the president. They were spied upon all over the place. And this was the basic information that later showed up at the desk of a provincial judge in a small southern state in Brazil. Why this guy? Very simple, because this guy was already an asset, Judge Sergio Moro. He had been invited by the State Department, one of those courses in Washington. So he was already an asset. He was remote controlled, obviously, from the beginning. And he was handpicked to conduct the car wash investigation. This investigation, because it was so huge, it should have been conducted by a prosecutorial office in Brasilia or in São Paulo, the two main centers, judicial centers in Brazil, not in a lowly southern state, by a lowly provincial judge. So this proves to everybody that this thing was politicized from the beginning. Of course, The fact that because Brazil, unlike the U.S., political lobbying is not regulated, it's a sort of a Tarantino-styled Wild West in terms of political campaign financing. So politicians, they go left and right, up and down to try to get some money. That includes state-owned enterprises. That includes private enterprises. And that includes what happened in the case of Petrobras and construction companies. Construction companies will get very good deals building stuff for Petrobras. And obviously there was a 5% that would find its way towards selected politicians, including worker party politicians as well. The corruption in Brazilian political system, it's all over the place. It's in workers' party and especially all across the right-wing opposition and the extreme right-wing opposition.
Well, that begs the question. You talk about corruption being so widespread, and I'm wondering if that understanding is fairly well known among the wider Brazilian population, that this isn't just a workers' party thing, like pox on all their houses or whatever. Do the Brazilian people understand that this goes beyond the workers' party?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It depends, of course, what you mean by Brazilian. Brazil is an extremely complex country in socioeconomic terms. If we're talking about deep Brazil, what in Brazil is considered social classes C and D. You mean the poor, the lower middle class, the urban proletariat, and the poor, and peasants, let's put it this way. For them, everything that happens in Brasilia or has happened in Brasilia, linked or not linked to car wash, it's a war amongst elites. It does not concern them. But they see it. They see the elites fighting among themselves. And obviously, the Workers' Party is part of this elite as well because they are the party in power in Brasilia. For the urban middle class in the more developed states in Brazil, in the southeast especially, this proves once again that the Workers' Party is a bunch of lowly communists. They are corrupt to the core and they must be criminalized and sidelined from Brazilian political life. This is the view that you see in the global media empire, which in terms of concentration of power, concentration of media power in the global south is it's absolutely unheard of and it's massive. It would be like comparing with U.S. if you had NBC, ABC, CNN all together in one conglomerate controlling the airwaves, especially TV. And three or four major newspapers, two in São Paulo, two in Rio, that these are the so-called newspapers, the national newspapers of record, in fact. And most of the urban middle class and the upper middle classes in Brazil, they follow these papers, even though, of course, like everywhere else, circulation is declining, etc. All of these were pro-impeachment, pro-coup, and pro-car wash. So you can imagine, just to give you the perspective, Dilma was re-elected in November 2014. Since even before she was reelected, her government, even before Dilma II started, end of Dilma I was already confronted too. Every day there was a scandal in the 8 o'clock nightly news, the global 8 o'clock nightly news, and in the big papers, front page stories, day after day after day. So she was prevented from governing from day one, even before day one of Dilma II. And these two things were, the progress was in parallel, like you said in the beginning. The car wash investigation, which centered only on Workers' Party politicians, and the fact that Dilma could not more or less control or have a good dialogue with Congress. Congress in Brazil nowadays, especially under Dilma too, was a pool of sharks. And she was not a politician experienced enough or savvy enough to know how to control these people. Lula was. Lula has always been a master politician, a master negotiator, and he knows Brazil like nobody else, with all his faults, of course. But he knew how to control Congress and Senate, allocate a favor here, a favor there. So basically, the Workers' Party and their main coalition partner, the PMDB, could actually run the government. Dilma was inexperienced enough and too closed on herself. She was never a dialogue person. She was too authoritarian. She wanted to run the economy, and she doesn't know much about economics. So much of what happened to her later on, she brought upon herself. But that also, we always have to consider the fact that she is not guilty of any wrongdoing. Okay. Very, very important. So car wash went after Lula, blaming him for dodgy wrongdoings, like he owned a seaside apartment and a ranch in the state of São Paulo, when in fact he didn't. He got kickbacks when he was in a lecture circuit all across the world, and this was proved to be completely bogus as well. And against Dilma, they had nothing. So they had to come up with, when I say they, it's an alignment of the BBBs that we spoke of, these three very powerful lobbies inside Congress, parts of the judicial system in Brazil, at least half of the Brazilian Supreme Court, which is heavily politicized, like it is in the U.S., for instance, and mainstream media. So these four very powerful actors were trying to, okay, we tried against Lula, it didn't work. Let's go after Dilma big, big time. And then later on, we go against Lula again. And that's exactly where we are at the moment.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. You say that basically the United States has been acting behind the scenes to kind of instigate this whole affair, and I think you used the term hybrid war in reference to this whole situation. I was wondering if you could explain, if that is the case, what are the principal motives of Washington in this drama?
Exactly. It is. I wrote about Brazil being the most sophisticated hybrid war phenomenon so far. It was a mix of slow motion coup, impeachment, or as the Brazilian creative activity denominated it golpeachment. Golpe is Portuguese for coup. So this neologism perfectly explains that. It was a slow motion golpeachment, not directly linked to a corruption investigation car wash, but mounted in parallel and in secret inside Congress. So you had parts of the judicial system giving the go-ahead for the golpeachment to proceed. Congress and Senate working together to ensure they had the numbers so impeachment would pass in both houses. The mainstream media from the beginning selling that the country was dead, paralyzed, paralyzed, Dilma was over, and they had to go through the next thing without analyzing the merit of the question if she was guilty or not. So all the major actors are more or less aligned. Your question is the heart of the matter in geopolitical terms, of course. Cui bono? Who profits from all this? Well, now there's an enormous list of grievances that Washington had vis-a-vis Lula and vis-a-vis Dilma, the two Lula governments, the first Dilma administration and a part of the second. The most important is the famous Bill Clinton question, it's the oil stupid. It's the pre-salt deposits that were discovered by Petrobras themselves with Petrobras indigenous technology without help of any of the oil majors from anywhere, US, Canada, Europe, the Chinese, Gazprom, you name it. These reserves are, you know, conservative estimates that these reserves are worth $8 trillion U.S. dollars. The problem is Lula, before he left, he ensured that Petrobras would be the sole exploiter and seller of rights, you name it, of these reserves. This for American big oil is an absolute anathema, as all of us know. Not by accident, the guy who's now the Brazilian foreign minister, José Serra, which is an absolutely appalling character and a sore loser as well, a senator. He lost a presidential election to Lula, and he's trying to come back ever since by lateral means, not by direct elections, because he'll never be directly elected to anything in Brazil. He promised to Chevron 4 or 5 years ago that if there was any sort of upside-down situation in the Brazilian government, Chevron and obviously ExxonMobil will be in for the spoils related to pre-salt. So the oil question in all this is absolutely paramount. Number two point is BRICS. BRICS, as you know, is a very, very dirty world in the Beltway, not only in Washington and the Beltway, but in Wall Street as well. And the fact that China, you know, dethroned the U.S. as the main trading partner in Brazil, the fact that Lula and then Dilma had very, very good, and they have very good relationships with, especially with Putin and Xi Jinping in China, the fact that there is a closer partnership between Brazil and Russia, and now a strategic partnership between Brazil and China, and lots of Chinese investment all over Brazil. This also for Washington is absolute anathema. So one of the key moves for this interim government at the moment is to try to de-link Brazil from the BRICS and relink Brazil with American interests, especially. And also Mercosur, UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations and the South American Common Market, this is not a priority for the right-wing interests and for these interests allied with Washington. And the fact that, of course, that for years, while the U.S. was involved in wars in Iraq, in Afghanistan, they forgot about South America. So there was this pink wave all across South America. The Workers' Party is not a red party in the Chinese sense. The Workers' Party was always pink. They even used neoliberal practices. But Lula was always very clever. because he had his set of priorities from the beginning. Let's try to make this country less unequal. It's still one of the most unequal countries in the global South, and even more important because it's the seventh largest economic power in the world. Let's make this more unequal. Let's have 30, 40 million people who have always been excluded become at least part of the middle class in Brazil. And little by little, we'll be tackling all problems related to inequality. This is something that Dilma was supposed to do, and she never managed to, because there was the global the commodity crisis all over the world. Brazil didn't have a plan B. The plan A was always to sell commodities, especially to China. There was not enough investment in education from day one in Brazil, including Lula. But Lula always said, look, we don't have enough money to do all this. First, I need to get these people out of poverty. Second, I'm going to invest in education long term. So there are some good educational policies put in place by Lula and by Dilma, but these are long term. You're going to reap the rewards in one generation from now. So it's a very, very long term process. So these gains will all be reversed if this interim government lasts more than 180 days. Yeah, and this will be one of the things we're going to discuss pretty soon. Is this government going to last, or is this going to last until the next presidential elections in 2018? And this is exactly it's what Washington is betting on. Because to revert most of these social conquests by the Workers' Party and especially the international foreign policy alliances of Brazil, you cannot unravel all this in 2, 3, 4 months. You need at least 2 years, 2.5 years, in fact, until 2018. Assuming they will have their candidate winning the elections in 2018, which is a big if.
That's very interesting. I'm curious to know, looking ahead, you're expecting that Lula will be will contest the 2018 election. And the question of what do you anticipate will be the outcome, or for that matter, what do you see happening as this whole drama unfolds over the next couple of years? Is it looking bad for Brazil, or is it going to is the fight back going to be successful?
Well, bad doesn't even begin to explain it in terms of the poorest Brazilians who, you know, their constitutional rights are being attacked as we speak. And it's not only the fact that, for instance, they canceled the Ministry of Culture, and then the 2 or 3 days later, because there was even an international uproar about it, okay, we're going to have it back, but we need a woman to lead it. They invite 5 Brazilian women personalities, they all reject it. So the Walking Dead interim government is already there. It is Walking Dead for all that matter. The problem is how long this thing is going to last. These next 180 days are going to be crucial, because for Dilma to be impeached for good, they need 2/3 of the votes in the Senate. It's not clear as we speak that they have these 2/3. Some people who voted for impeachment in the previous Senate vote, they are already changing their minds when they look at what this government has managed, has managed to not accomplish in 5 days. They took the country back at least 50 years in their 5, 6 days in power. It's amazing. They, for instance, they have a ministry of the new minister of industry. He goes on record saying that I have no experience in industry whatsoever, apart from the fact that I was an accountant at the start of my career. It's beyond Kafka, but with very seriously tragic overtones to all of it. The fact that they're planning to cancel social programs in terms of help for the needy, construction of popular housing all across Brazil. The fact that they are antagonizing their neighbors, Bolivia, Ecuador, Venezuela, via exactly this guy who wants to basically take the B out of BRICS. The fact that, for instance, there was during the Cannes Film Festival, the crew of one of the Brazilian movies being shown at the Cannes Film Festival, they went live with a protest while they were climbing the red carpet, and this was caught by cameras all over the world. So now everywhere all over the world, people know that there is a coup going on in Brazil and the current government is illegitimate. By the way, nobody anywhere for this past week, their first week in power, recognized the current interim illegal government in Brazil. Nobody. Obviously, the U.S. Tersely, via the State Department, has said that Brazil has, you know, the usual platitudes, a strong economic fundamentals, is a strong democracy, blah, 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 blah. So they are more or less endorsing what's going on without totally endorsing it. And the Russian foreign minister already said that there has been foreign interference in Brazil, which coming from Moscow, it's pretty, pretty strong diplomatic language. The Chinese haven't said a word. And as far as I know, they're following it very closely because they're expecting Dilma to talk to them directly and explain what's going on. After all, this is BRICS, and they have a summit later this year as well. And the BRICS, the leadership in the BRICS, they are not going to recognize these people in power in Brazil. The problem is the internal political situation in Brazil is so complex, and it changes every 24 hours. So nobody has a crystal ball to say whether this illegal interim government is going to last the 180 days, including during the Olympics in Brazil, which is, I'm sure, Brazilians, poorer Brazilians, working class people, artists and intellectuals, and even sportsmen in Brazil, they will be denouncing this illegal government during the Olympic Games in Rio. Hmm. So this is going to be an extremely embarrassing situation for Brazilia, like 2 months from now, right?
Yeah.
And obviously, long term is, there are two main objectives related to the car wash investigation and the impeachment process. Number one is to get over with Dilma. We can say that they more or less accomplished the first stage. It's going to be very hard for her to be back in power. And she, if she's back in power, she has to sell the nation a program for the rest of her mandate, which she doesn't have as we speak. And the number two objective is to criminalize Lula and to get rid of Lula, because these aligned powers that we were discussing a while ago, their number one obsession is Lula cannot run again in 2018, because they know, and all the recent polls have said the same thing, if he runs, he wins. And then everything that happened since the re-election of Dilma, November 2014, including car wash, impeachment, impeachment, etc., would be for nothing. And because Lula back in power in 2018, he will have a more streamlined, corruption-free program to sell to Brazilian society. And deep Brazil, especially the poorest part of the country, they will buy it.
Well, Pepe Escobar, I want to thank you very much for this very pertinent analysis and your unique insights into this whole drama, and certainly look forward to reading more of your articles in the coming weeks. So thank you very much for joining us on the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you, Michael. Look, we barely scratched the surface. This is one of the saddest political stories in modern times. And obviously, all of us all over the Global South, we have to follow it very, very closely. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. We've been joined by Pepe Escobar, independent geopolitical analyst. He writes for a number of outlets, and much of his articles are compiled on the Global Research website. Political turmoil currently underway in Brazil is having an impact on the indigenous population of the region. To tell us more, we're bringing back John Aniwanika Certo. He is the Winnipeg-based editor and publisher of Intercontinental Cry, an online media hub for news and analysis of indigenous struggles around the world. Thank you for joining us, John.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I guess first off, I wanted to just bring up briefly, there's a story here of the Climate News Network reporting about indigenous and environmental laws
that are being rolled back as a result of this bill, PEC 65-2012.
Yep.
And it's apparently going to act as a boost to infrastructure projects threatening the ecosystem. And this is all happening amid the – or being largely eclipsed by what's happening with the Dilma Rousseff impeachment. So I was wondering if you might be able to just explain briefly what you see as the practical outcome of the passage of that bill, and given some of the infrastructure and industrial work being pursued in the country.
Well, first, I think it's noting that it's worth noting that it's a significance to see this bill being pushed forward right now in the midst of everything that's been going on with Rousseff and the quick movements of the new governments to push Brazil in the direction that is beneficial for industry and the rich in particular. But this particular bill, proposed Constitutional Amendment 65. Would allow major infrastructure projects to go ahead regardless of their impacts on biodiversity, indigenous lands, and conservation areas. For example, the Belmonte Dam, which is currently on hold because of the failure of the government to consult indigenous peoples with regard to the impacts, could now just be simply dismissed under this law, and project could just steamroll ahead, and that could be the case for every other project in Brazil. So it's definitely a major concern, and I think it's a signature of what we can expect to see with this new government while it's in office.
On your website, they announced a landmark win against hydro dams on indigenous lands in Brazil, and the FUNAI, F-U-N-A-I, decision protecting Munduruku lands from the development of a hydro dam destruction.
Yes.
And do you see that being rolled back in any way, or is that fairly?
Well, yeah, it could be if the government now decides to. The FUNAI, which is the government agency responsible for creating policies and laws for indigenous peoples and representing indigenous peoples' interests in Brazil, formally recognized the Munduruku's lands, which protects it from this hydro project. But it's not expressly official until the president signs off on the project. Rousseff probably would have done so because of the Munduruku's very militant stance. Like they're committed to physically, sacrificing their lives en masse to defend their territory. And the Rousseff government obviously wouldn't want to have blood on its hands, at least not directly. So it would have likely signed off on the demarcation or recognition of the Munduruku's lands. But now with Temer in office, who knows? My inclination is to believe that he'll just say, well, who cares? They're just Indians. But, I guess we'll have to see what happens here.
Yeah. Well, could you talk about this, the FUNAI? You seem to have expressed some concerns to me about this group being shut down. That's not confirmed at all, right?
No, it's just rumor at this point. FUNAI was established in 1967 in response to a 7,000-page report by the Figueiredo Commission, which was tasked with investigating the atrocities carried out by the Indian Protection Service, which was at the time the government agency responsible for indigenous affairs. SPI's original mandate was to assimilate Brazil's indigenous peoples, but the agency graduated, I suppose you could say, into a genocidal beast. For over 40 years, the SPI carried out an endless line of crimes against humanity, including mass murder, genocide, torture, enslavement, bacteriological warfare, mass sexual abuse, and land theft. Now, this key report exposed SPI's brutal legacy to the world, resulting in the dissolution of the SPI and the creation of its predecessor, which is FUNAI. Now the so it's not just, you know, like I often describe Funai as the Brazilian equivalent of Indian and Northern Affairs, but and it is in many respects, aside from the fact that it also represents, it's a symbol of the of a shift from the, you know, genocidal mentality that existed to one that's a little more human or mature, responsible, you know. And the fact that Funai could now be axed with the level of racism that exists in Brazil, I think is something that everybody should be very concerned about. And I know indigenous peoples in Brazil are concerned, and they're watching very closely to see what steps the government takes here.
This report you mentioned, it's somehow been covered up or subverted?
Well, it's. And that's an interesting story, actually. The report was lost or believed to be lost in a fire. The report was there was only one copy of the report. It was never made public before it could go public. The offices of the SPI burned to the ground mysteriously, and so the report was thought to be lost in the fire. As it turned out, though, that wasn't the case. But unfortunately, because the report was lost, the SPI was never legally held responsible for its actions, and the dozens of government agencies that were identified in the report were never held accountable. The entire history was just basically swept under the rug. Unfortunately, though, it turns out that the report wasn't lost. It was actually discovered in 2013 in the SPI's old building, which in the 1970s became, or maybe it was the 80s, became the Museum of the Indian. Unfortunately, the museum was actually scheduled to be destroyed for the World Cup. It was going to be mowed down for a new parking lot, but before the government actually moved forward with it, somebody went through the old building, which is, you know, falling apart in some areas, and, you know, found in some corner in some room the report. Unfortunately, there was one chapter in the report that was missing, but, you know, probably about 6,500 pages of the report were sitting right there in boxes. So the report is now being reviewed by various agencies in Brazil. I'm not sure if it's been made public yet, but hopefully some copies have actually been made, so that, you know, the individuals can be held accountable, because, you know, like this all happened in this legacy ended in the 1960s, 1970s. So
yeah, 50 years.
So. Yeah, so like everybody's, you know, still around and. Still, and the racism that existed from those days also very much still exists.
So what kinds of protections are there for indigenous peoples in Brazil beyond individual human lives? Are there protections for them as a people?
Well, there are constitutional protections. Like for example, there are actually very strong protections for indigenous lands. I don't know the details. I only know the outcome. There was one ruling in a few years ago on the in the area called Raposa Serra do Sol, where non-indigenous peoples had invaded the territory over decades and were pushing the indigenous peoples off their lands. So the court ruled in light of the constitutional protections of indigenous lands that the non-indigenous inhabitants had to vacate with compensation, but they still had to leave because they were occupying the land illegally. And, you know, impressively, for all the difficulty that the Brazilian government has had over the last while, even going back to Rousseff's predecessor, you know, Da Silva, he ordered the government to obey the law, and as a consequence, they, you know, forced the non-indigenous inhabitants off the indigenous land. And I think that's actually an incredibly rare thing for a government to do. Like, not even Bolivia or Venezuela have gone so far to protect indigenous lands. So it was a remarkable win, and there have been other instances of that happening as well in Brazil. So I don't know any specific laws that are protecting indigenous peoples. You know, there has been a sentiment to protect indigenous peoples and indigenous lands on the government floor, to an extent at least. You know, like with the that's not the case with the Congress, which is controlled by the very powerful agribusiness lobby in the country. And what I mean by powerful is if you combine the tobacco lobby in the U.S. and the oil lobby and the beef lobby and the chicken and egg lobby, combine them, and that's the strength of the agribusiness lobby in Brazil. You know, they own Congress, and what they want usually goes forward. Mm. And one of the things they've been pushing really hard for is another constitutional amendment called PEC 215. And this would give Congress the unprecedented power to control the legality of indigenous lands in Brazil. That power usually rests with the president. So, for example, the Munduruku lands that were just recognized by FUNAI, if PEC 215 goes forward, Congress could either reorganize the borders that FUNAI defined for the Munduruku, or it could just toss out the claim altogether. And that is actually expected to be passed within the next couple of weeks, despite the fact that indigenous peoples have been, organizing routinely for over 3 years to prevent this law going forward. And they've done a good job lobbying against this project, considering the fact that they're pushing against the agribusiness lobby. But now it seems like their efforts may have been in vain. But of course, I don't think Brazil's indigenous peoples are going to take this sitting down. There is a very strong indigenous movement in Brazil, and we're already seeing signs that they're not actually going to sit idly by. That they're going to push and push hard. Possibly even organizing on the level that we've seen in Colombia and Ecuador over the last decade or so.
Well, John Chertow, I really appreciate this update on the situation in Brazil, as depressing as it seems in some respects. But thank you very much for sharing it with us.
Certainly.
We've been speaking with John Aniwanika Chertow. His website is intercontinentalcry.org.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.